For a different age I was born, every man has once said. For each was to honour Swan, rather to all this cowardice bred. Thus for a gilded time we mourn, insisting such days forever dead. Yet of all the feelings ever known, longing for a time not your own is when true cowardice is shown, especially if dark the age has grown.
All right, welcome to episode 56% of Strike and Mike, your favorite 56%.
Hello, the show. 56% show.
Yeah,
the two everyone who has brown eyes is 56%. Always remember that.
Yeah, this is the biggest pro Maduro 56% or show on there, right?
Maduro.
Well, as it turns out, you know, that Maduro's seems to have died down a bit.
Maduro's like at 18%. Yeah. Maduro's a fucking Zambo.
Yeah, no, I know. No, but that whole speaking of Venezuela, that whole thing seems to have died down a bit, and of course the narrative that we had, I don't know that we ever covered this, the narrative that we were pushing, that this truck incident with this burning trucks and, oh, they're burning aid. Even the New York Times had to come out and admit that that was totally bogus. Even freaking Bellingcat had to, like, reluctantly admit that turned out to just be bullshit, that was started by...
Oh, they love their hoaxes. You know, Bellingcat, not to change the topic. Oh, we also wanted to talk about Fox News and stuff like that, so we should talk about that in a minute.
But yeah, Bellingcat is...
Bellingcat's Robert Evans went on a program yesterday demanding that everyone start doxing the political dissidents and their white nationalists and alt-right and quote far-right people. He was on Slate calling for people to dox them because the police aren't doing their job in arresting people for their ideas. So leftists have to take actions into their own hands. That's one of the narratives from a writer from Bellingcat.
Yeah, and Bellingcat is, just so people understand, Bellingcat is, if people might not know what it is, it's the home of online investigations, where these people basically go in and they do like these phony, they basically create like propaganda that favors whatever Zog wants to do, particularly foreign policy wise, particularly with the Middle East. Although they also did it with Venezuela, which is why it was remarkable that even they had to admit that the stuff about the burning trucks was just a complete fake and gay thing that was like, you know, there was a protest and somebody threw a Molotov cocktail, a truck caught on fire, and they tried to make that like, it was most likely that the Molotov cocktail came from Jardia forces, or what's his name, Juan Jardia. It was like pro Jardia protesters.
I think that gay op dissipated, it collapsed. They tried to cut their power from the power grid. And that's actually an old CIA trick when they want.
Well, that's the other thing is that they were saying, I mean, Marco Rubio.
They got the Chinese to go and bring their power back on the online.
Well, Marco Rubio has been one of the loudest voices calling for an intervention down in Venezuela. And he on his Twitter, you know, he's also posting the gore porn with Gaddafi and such. On his Twitter, he posts a video of the transformer explosion. And he's like, look, the infrastructure down at Venezuela, because of the communist regime, has degraded so much that their transformers are just, I was like, oh yes, the transformers just randomly exploding at a time when they're being targeted by like the CIA. I mean, you think I'm fucking stupid?
Right.
Like, come on. And it's just not going anywhere. Like, nobody's buying it. I mean, Marco Rubio seems to be a designated point man on this, but Marco Rubio, who listens to him really?
Who cares?
Nobody cares.
All I know is that the whole thing with that seems to be
It's not going.
It's not going to happen.
No, nothing's going to happen.
And you know that is a subtle failure, but it's one in a string of failures from U.S. foreign policy. There seems to be, you know, there seems to be a trend where American interventions abroad, whether covert or overt, seem to be they're having diminishing returns on these conflicts. And
there's been too many gay ops.
Yeah.
And the fact, this is probably another reason why they, you know, it's like Bellingcat, interestingly enough, Bellingcat was one of their attempts at countering online people saying this is a false flag, this is fake. Right?
Right.
Now, not that everybody saying something is a false flag is correct. Quite often they're wrong, such as a very recent, a spectacular case of, I think, people calling false flag being wrong. But, you know, they are very frustrated by this, because when that happens, it's a way of getting even, like, grug people to go against it.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's got, in sort of a metapolitical way, a lot of these sort of paranoid people that, even if their narrative is wrong, they still get that this is fishy. There's something wrong here. This isn't right. So even if they're pointing the fingers in all directions that aren't necessarily the correct place, they see that it's just bullshit. And too many
people. And you know, there's also a problem where people, I believe I saw Joe Concha talking about this yesterday. He was saying that 77% of Americans don't trust anything the media says. So, you know, you don't have the same public faith in institutions. Now, let me tell you a little bit about what they call democracy, right? So the liberal theory is that the character of a people doesn't matter, like the characteristics, the racial or national or ethnic cultural characteristics of a people are irrelevant. What is relevant is the institutions. Right. That's why anytime you see these Jewish neoliberals going out there, they're always talking about defending our democratic institutions or defending our liberal institutions. So once people lose faith in those things as a kind of magical arbiter or referee or whatever, something that makes, quote, democracy possible is the theory. You have a situation where people just don't follow along anymore. Like, you know, the new American experience went from a radical populism in 2016 to now in 2019, increasing apathy.
Yeah. And cynicism.
And you know, the media to an extent would actually prefer the apathy, the depoliticization, as I would say, because, you know, once you start seeing, like, I'm starting to see more shit. Like, I was talking about this the other day. Like, I'm starting to see shit about California v. Michael Jackson in the headlines again, or Madeleine McCann, or things like that. Mm-hmm. Whenever they start trotting that shit out again, it's because they want to distract from the political things and political.
I noticed that they did put this new thing about Michael Jackson out, and people that were like, people have an eye towards like funny conspiracies were looking at it again, and I was just like, who cares, really? I mean, yeah, maybe there's something, there might be something interesting there, but I don't give a shit. But I did want to go back to the Bellingcat thing, because I think that we never finished that point.
I'll say about Michael Jackson, sometimes boys want to be boys, and you need an alarm in the hallway outside of your bedroom, because you don't want icky poopy adults to crash in on you when you're playing Captain Hook and Peter Pan, right? Because that ruins the imagination and the experience. So, totally, Michael's innocent, in other words.
Okay. I don't even really want to talk about that, because
no, but seriously speaking, though, when we're talking about Michael Jackson again, it's a sign that people are losing interest in politics.
Yeah, well, it's an attempt to deliberately distract them. It's an attempt to get your conspiratorial brain looking at something different than politics.
Celebrity stuff.
Yeah. And there are a lot of weird things about that, but like, I just don't really care. It's not going to be anything groundbreaking. I did want to go back to the Bellingcat thing, because as we see the U.S. propaganda for these foreign interventions just failing and falling flat time and time again, you know, Bellingcat is there to be like a non-official. Like, they set this up. It's totally fake and gay. It's totally institutional, but they set it up as if it's not. They're astroturfing it to make it look like it's not institutional, to make it look like it's just some interested investigators that came together to start looking into things and giving you the real scoop. And they make it kind of look like a conspiracy site. If you look at the design of the site, you know what I mean? It looks like, it's like deliberately not like a corporate news type of, design. It's got like a big question. It's got like a question mark in the logo, and it's used like a typewriter font. You know what I mean? So they make it look like it's, and it was, and the first time I saw it, like when I first was introduced to it a few years ago, I was a little bit confused, because I was like, wait, this is the Zog line. Like, they're giving me Zog shit, but they're presenting it. So it actually did. My brain was like briefly like, but then I wrapped my mind. I was like, oh yeah, this is some fucking astroturfed fucking gay shit. But, they were pushing things like in April of 2018, like, oh no, in that, you know, that fake, that thing, which has now totally been, definitely fake, the gas attack that spurred the second Trump bombing of Syria, totally fake. The UN, chemical weapons inspection agency went in and they were like, yeah, there's no attack here.
Well, right. Remember they blamed the Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, the crash. They blamed that on Russia.
Yeah.
They were the ones that they did their own investigation.
Yeah.
And they found that it was actually Russia that was behind it.
Yeah. And they've been going after actual Russia evidence for
that.
A while.
Yeah. You know, it's very, very salient that you say that they're meant to look like a conspiracy theory site, because they actually do kind of work that angle. Like they work, they're like InfoWars, but the conspiracy theories always
favor Zog.
Push the Zog narratives on things.
Yeah.
It's actually really funny that you mentioned that.
That's why it confused me when I first saw it. But then it turns out, like, once you see what it is, it's like, oh, this is just AstroTurf shit where they're trying to, they're trying to counter the people online who, whether they're right or not, are like just throwing cold water on all this Zog shit, right? Just
right.
The people that are just like, yeah, we just don't believe it. Like, it's just obviously CIA or Mossad or whatever. Like, we just don't believe it, right? And that's just so prevalent. Like, at least half the country immediately says, like, CIA or Mossad when they see something, you know, or both, or intertwined, right, or whatever. Like,
the reason for that is, again, the loss of faith, mm-hmm, in the media, in the public institutions, which is actually completely justified, because when you in your day-to-day life see something and then you look at the news and they say the opposite of what you've seen with your own two eyes, you're not going to trust anything else they say either, and with good reason. So, like, this is the kind of problem these the Jewish power structure and cultural institutions are having right now with the white population in particular.
Yeah.
And you know, once the white majority stops falling for their gay ops, what's left? Well, brutality, oppression, putting people in jail. And that's what this new FBI House Democrat FBI thing is. I don't know if you heard of this. They want to pull the FBI, which my narrative on that is that's a good thing. We want the spotlight on the FBI and what they've been up to in the last 2 years in respects to political dissidents and nationalists, because what they've been doing,
explain the House you cut off. Explain the House Democrat thing you were going
to
say.
So the House Democrats, after the New Zealand shooting, want to bring the FBI for a congressional hearing. To ask them what exactly they're doing to shut down white nationals.
Yes.
And I welcome that in the headlines, because what they're doing is actually really un-American. They're actually violating people's rights. They're putting people – I mean the Rise Above Movement guys, alleged Rise Above Movement members, are being charged with a crime that has not been used in like 50 or 60 years, and that has been legal experts have dubbed as a political prosecution. It's a crime that's only used to suppress political speech. And on top of that, it's a selective prosecution depending on your political ideology. The Antifa do not get brought up on rioting.
Yeah, and the Antifa are arguably actually in much, much more significantly in violation of this, because they don't even have the excuse of, you know, they don't have any excuse, so to speak. Like, you know, we've been over this before, but the Riot Act, the Anti-Riot Act, is something that came into play in the 60s. And it came into play because there was a lot of riots. Right.
Right.
And the thing is, when there's various anti-riot acts in multiple states, and there's a Washington DC anti-riot act, and there's a federal anti-riot act. Federal anti-riot act is what these guys are being charged under. And they're being charged under conspiracy to riot, and then conspiracy to cross state lines. Cause that's the only way federal agents can start investigating, is if you cross state lines. That's like the abuse of the Commerce Clause that like, actually, frankly, conservatives and libertarians have been complaining about for decades, is that the federal government abuses their power in this way. And they're correct about this.
Right. The government tried to use stuff like the Rioting Act against, like, for example, the Freedom Riders, right? I mean, we always hear about how Martin Luther King actually always, he just didn't use violence, which is a total lie, total fucking retcon. Martin Luther King's movement was extremely violent, And the Montgomery riots were pretty famous, and it was led by Freedom Riders. But of course, back then, the Freedom Riders, who were largely Jewish, had lawyers. They had people like, maybe not Morris Dees specifically, but people like that that would defend them in court and beat the government when they would use these to try and, frankly, keep law and order, but also as a periphery thing, kind of pull back some of these leftist radicals.
Well, yeah, they were put in place, and they were specifically to respond to rioting. But one of the interesting things that happens, and this is, I think, something that's going to be difficult for the courts to contend with, I talked about this on TDS a couple of weeks ago, is that there were judges that in the 60s put specific limitations on the DC Anti-Riot Act specifically, which is that, like, this can't be invoked for disturbances that arise out of legitimate political protest. So, mm-hmm. like the 68 Democrat convention was a big, big riots broke out outside of that, right?
Yeah.
But it was something that arose out of people legitimately going to protest politically using First Amendment free speech rights, and then, you know, alternating factions and police just getting into a rumble. And so you can't be accused of like rioting and conspiracy if you just went to a legitimate event and then it broke out into a fight, right? You can't, and even in the judges in the 60s recognize this, and they're like, we're not going to let the federal government come in and pick and choose people, take sides in these political scuffles. And see, in the 60s, they would do that because, you know, there was powerful people on each side of the equation, so to speak. But now there's not. And it's now very one-sided. There's no powerful people on the side of the alt-right. So they will try to do this. But we've been over that a lot.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think that is.
I think one thing I will say.
I think that is interesting about the House Democrat panel.
The 68 convention riots, you know, rioting outside of political conventions was actually a way that people were able to influence the discussion inside, at least protests, right? Not just rioting, but protests in general. Now they have all these laws where you have to, they have free speech zones where you can't be directly outside of the convention or anywhere really near it. They have you kind of segregated and roped off so that no one can actually hear what you're saying, so that it doesn't have any impact on the discussion.
Well, I remember the protests outside the 2004 Republican convention in New York City, which was a flex. Putting it in New York City was a flex on the left by the neocons. It was like, we're going to do this. We're going to
also where they all live.
Well, that's the funny thing, but I mean, whatever but it was them saying, like, we're going to put George W. Bush plop down in the middle of Manhattan, and all the leftist radicals in New York City that are against the Iraq war are going to come out. And they did. It was largely peaceful, though. I mean, there's probably some people that got arrested. I don't remember. I was there. I was in the crowds. I wasn't participating in any, you know, big actions, but I was just like kind of observing, watching, going from protest to protest, checking it out. And it wasn't really that much action. There was a lot of people, but there wasn't really any hot and heavy action because it was so clamped down. But like it was kind of a flex. And the Republicans inside had no reason to listen to those people because they weren't their constituents in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, I think it is interesting that this FBI House panel or the House are going to bring in the FBI to talk about this. Now, the other thing with this, which is possibly, I think, a benefit to white nationalists, is a large amount of this House investigation, they're trying to connect this to Donald Trump because they're still on this like impeachment quest. And if they do that, the whole thing is just going to be stupid. So it's like, you know, it's going to be just dumb. I don't know. I don't think
it has anything to do with Trump. I think they've made the establishment's made peace with Trump. And, what I think is that we're going to see if Trump was ever, if he was a shill the whole time, or if he was just browbeat by this coup, when the Mueller report comes out. A lot of people actually don't talk about the Mueller report because it is really stupid.
Well, it's a talking hoax, about it anymore is like who right. I don't but even care it, about it anymore.
When it does come out and it does exonerate Trump, we'll see what he does after that. Like maybe you know, I'm not going to hold out hope for it.
But he's maybe, not going to do anything.
Right. But there's a 1 in 10 chance maybe that he'll go back to how he used to be after they exonerate him. But anyway.
Well, I mean, the biggest problem is his son-in-law. But, like,
the Democrats aren't targeting Trump. They're targeting us.
Well, maybe. I still think there's some of them that still are on this impeachment kick. We'll see what happens. But, yes, I think now they are, you know, Elizabeth Warren says yesterday, on Twitter that, we need to call out white nationalism. As president, my Justice Department will prosecute them with full force. And I'm like, for what? For being white nationalists? And then like there was a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of people in the comments that were like, wait, what are you talking about? For what? Like just for, and then there was the grug brain leftists like, you, well, these people are terrorists, of course. And it's like,
yeah, I mean, seeing Antifa people that, you know, there's stuff going on with the Rise Above movement. There was a motion to dismiss and the FBI responded. They wrote a response to it, a really crappy one, but I'm not going to go into that.
Oh, I haven't looked at that yet. I got to look.
When you have hardened extremist anarchists calling your FBI motion fire, like I saw that, they were like, this FBI response is fire.
That's like,
and then this person has an ACAB fucking anarchist flag in their avatar with Emma Goldman. I mean,
it's like, maybe think about what you're doing there, guy. Like, you know, I don't know. It's like, well, that's always been my message to these people. It's like, do you even understand what role you're playing here? Like,
well, I mean, they understand that they're hypocrites. You know,
some of them do, but one thing,
Christopher Lash, I'm reading a Christopher Lash book right now. And one thing he says about the Judeo left is that they love to implement rules and laws that they secretly hope will never be applied to them. And so they kind of understand that on some level, perhaps even mistakenly, that the new surveillance things and civil liberties curtailments that they're pushing for will never apply to them because they're, you know, they've made peace with the establishment.
Yeah. And I remember being part of the left, the anti-war left in 2004, and they would never have been for this stuff because they thought that this stuff would come back on them. There was a point in the early 2000s where the left thought that they would be victim of this stuff. Now they are not under any illusion of that anymore. Well, they've also dropped any pretense of being anti-war, as we see in things like Bellingcat, to get back to that, are out there that are supposedly kind of a leftist bent, but they just push all this bullshit. And of course, then they're out there on Slate. See, think about Bellingcat. Both Fox News and Slate will promote it as if it's like, you know, these guys really got to the bottom of it. You know, oh, look, they found the canister in Syria and they're like, you know, here's a YouTube video of,
they're always
of a white helmet with
stuff.
A canister. It's just bullshit. But yeah.
Yeah.
But they of were course. Talking
another hoax they were going for last May. They were saying that the Venezuelan government was killing journalists or something, which I haven't looked into, but, you know, it's probably a load of shit. They're sticking with the gas story in Syria. They're constantly trying to set up Russia for things over the Ukraine. Yeah, it's, you know, it's perfect what you said before, that it's a conspiracy theory site that pushes the Zog line. It's meant to capture the people on the margins that love that kind of stuff. Like, some of them just find it entertaining.
Yeah.
And but this is obviously, it's got support from the status quo
but it's but of course that they're supporting, you know, this whole online investigations to go out and, like, you know, dox white nationalists and stuff. And yes, yeah. I mean, and there is this push after the New Zealand shooting, there is going to be this push by the establishment to further, you know, marginalize and essentially attempt to criminalize our beliefs. I think that the constitutional hurdle is going to be a big problem for them. And we have to make sure it's a problem for them. You know, we can't, this is the thing. You can't just give up on it. You have to say, like, no, like, I'm not a terrorist. This is an idea set, which I am allowed to have under the Constitution of the United States. You can't oppress me for this. No. And, you know, if heat comes down on us or on me, and, you know, that's my line, and that did nothing to do but stick to it. You know, like, if you want to investigate me, I mean, I'm sure that there's eyes on us to some extent. And, you know, that's why I'm not going to say
I think the sign here is that they're frustrated because they are calling for new laws and new tools in the toolbox.
Exactly.
Thomas Cullen. And the reason for that is that they probably are spending an enormous amount of money infiltrating shit like 8chan and maybe even some real life events and going there. And then they're sitting there saying, hey, anyone want to buy a gun? Anyone want to buy some drugs? Anyone want to join me beating up this nigger or shooting up this Muslim or whatever. So they go in real life and they do that shit. And all they get instead is autistic kids passing around Yang memes.
But it's more than that. I mean, think of the resources that have gone into them going after people. And the best they got is a few fistfights. Yeah. And they tried to amplify some fistfights into like a national conspiracy. Right. You know what I mean? Like the Ram thing.
And one car accident.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they've got.
I mean, do you know how many people get run over in this country every single day?
40,000 people die per year.
Yeah.
In car accidents. So it's like, which is actually terrible and a sign of a mismanaged traffic system. But that's another story. That's, you know, but, yes, if they have done this nationwide, since Charlottesville particularly, and now even more so, they are doing this sort of crackdown, but the best they've gotten is, you know, some guys that got into a rumble with some Antifa.
Yep.
An unplanned fight because they were drunk.
And even then they had to dust off this fucking archaic.
Yeah, and they had to dust off
speech law.
Yeah, they had to dust off this law that was disallowed 50 years ago.
White nationals bowling on Sunday. Like, you know, like the blue laws.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, they had to invoke a law that was.
We just pinched the goyish bowling club.
Yeah. It's not really a bowling club.
It's not really, no.
It's a rioting conspiracy. Yeah. And so it's like they had to take this law. 50 years ago, judges were like, you can't use this if people are engaged in legitimate political speech and like violence comes out of that. You can't apply this to that. This is only for like, and the funny thing is the only riots that kind of it does apply to are like white people don't really get involved in those kind of riots. Kind of like the, you know, like Detroit and Newark and then Ferguson later on where literally the riot is just cover for like looting and burning shit. The political pretext is very thin in that case. But they're not going to even apply it to that, right? Like, cause there were people that went to Ferguson with the specific intent.
Yeah.
Of taking that very thin pretext of the anger about the shooting and just whipping up a actual riot and actual looting and violence beyond anything.
Anarchists, all the white people that you saw at Ferguson were there. They were paid agitators from the Revolutionary Communist Party and from anarchist groups. And those are the same people that went to Charlottesville, by the way.
And it's far worse than anything we have ever done.
Those people, they specialize in triggering or organizing riots. And they were probably disappointed when instead of going fighting with the police, the blacks there went and looted the weave store.
Well, they definitely were. I mean, dude, it was so funny seeing those. Man, you know, it's funny because, you know, there's this thing where some so-called Ferguson activists, as they were saying, have like died in mysterious circumstances. But as it turns out, it's like, five of them were just gang shootings and one of them was just an overdose. And this guy, Bassem Masri, who was this, Arab, you know, leftist activist, he just died of a fent overdose. It's not suspicious. I mean, it's sad, but it's not suspicious.
I'm not going to judge him for that.
I'm not judging him, but it's like
people that have the problem, but yeah, those are the types of people.
I just do remember that he was the hilarity about Bassem Masri is he was at Ferguson in 2014, you know, as he's getting tear gassed, holding up his brand new iPhone 6, they're tear gassing us. And then boom, iPhone is like out of his hand and a swift black teen is like, and you see it like pumping up and down on his side. He's like, yo, new iPhone 6, nigga, new iPhone 6. It was like the funniest shit. It was all caught on live stream. It was so funny. And I almost feel sad that guy's dead.
A lot of the main rioters in Ferguson, like you were saying, a lot of them are dead actually. There's like seven or eight of them that died ever since.
Well, it's all gang shit. They were all found dead.
Like they were shot and this is actually in the Daily Mail. three of them were actually shot and found in burning cars. Another one was
well, that's a gang thing.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. But you know what's funny is that some of these Judeo leftists that don't really, because they don't live around black people and don't understand how things work in the hood, they're trying to create a conspiracy yes. theory saying that, you know, like racist cops are getting their revenge.
I know. And we actually covered this yeah. yesterday on TDS. Yeah. We don't need to go into it, but one of the Shaniquas that was a protester, like a bullet went through, she lives in Ferguson, a bullet went through her window and like almost missed her daughter, and who's her like 13-year-old daughter almost. And I'm like, well, that's a terrible thing, but that wasn't a white supremacist. That's what she said. No. She's like, she thinks I'm being targeted by a white supremacist. No, no. You don't actually think that. First of all, you are lying to the Associated Press reporter.
You want a GoFundMe.
Yeah, yeah.
To get like, you $20,000.
Yeah, it's like, come on. But yes, but the people instigating the riots there were far more instigating and could be accused under this act than anything that white nationalists have ever done. So yes. So what are they doing? I mean, this is, they are frustrated with political dissent, and they see a locus of it in this community, in the pro-white community, which has emerged. You know, the anti-war movement significantly went in two directions, into sort of the anti-Zionist left, which is actually dwindling, and then into the alt-right, which is, if not growing in apparent strength, certainly growing in numbers, in number of people thinking it.
Yeah.
If not in sort of like, you know, political strength because of people.
Simply to see the impact we are having, even in our restricted form, support for Israel amongst Republican voters has fallen by like 20% in the last like 2 years.
Oh, so, actually, I have the exact figures.
Oh,
so
got
we
it.
Don't get it wrong. In the last 2 years, support for Israel amongst "quote unquote" Republicans has fallen 12%, while it's only fallen 6% among Democrats.
Fascinating. So,
and if you remember the lobby, which we talked about, that was done in 2016.
Yeah.
And at that time, these AIPAC people were freaking out about their dwindling support on the left, and their dwindling support on college campuses. Their inability to control the narrative on college campuses, and their dwindling support in the Democratic Party, and essentially talking about, well, our support in the Republican Party is strong, though. Like, they are our people, right? And when it comes to the politicians, that's true. There's not a Republican politician, including Donald Trump, that is not completely and totally in the palm of Zionism. But in terms of the public, we now see, wow, you know, 12%? Of the people of Republicans in 2 years are like less supportive of Israel. That's a pretty big shift. And that's something that is since that AIPAC documentary was massive. Filmed. So those same people are now shitting their pants about the right. And that's one of the things I was saying is like,
and this lobby documentary. Right wing anti-Zionism is always far more scary to them.
Yes. Because it takes on a slightly different character, shall we say.
And another thing too is, one thing I'm noticing, their response is something you can see if you pay attention. For example, the American Conservative, which was actually a pretty solid publication after Trump got elected, they mm-hmm. took a shift to the Trump populism, and they started to really put in interesting articles. I saw Rod Dreher, who a lot of people know and don't like, but he was writing about tribalism and nationalism and racialism, and they had a lot of good anti-capitalist stuff and so on. The American Conservative the other day was writing about how Israel is the perfect national state and things like that. And so whenever you see that in a conservative publication, look at it like you would a Dr. Mercola article in Luke Rockwell. Okay.
Yeah.
That is paid advertisement. It's an infomercial. Anytime you see a conservative publication praising Israel, it is a late night TV infomercial.
Yeah.
So never take that for granted or treat it seriously. Do like you would with Dr. Mercola.
It's okay, also an attempt to harness what was the narrative that I did see bandied about, I would say, 4 or 5 years ago as the alt-right was first starting to coalesce out of various elements, libertarianism, anti-war elements, neo-reactionary elements. And when people were still, you know, when it was still I don't know, coalescing is the best word I can come up with. When the pot was still kind of brewing around, ideas being thrown around, and there was heavy debates about this and that. And the JQ was a big thing that was debated. And there was a faction that was like, well, Israel's what we want to be. Here you have a state that doesn't take shit, that doubles down every time, that goes 10 times as hard as they're hit every time they're hit, et cetera, et cetera. And don't we want to be like that? Shouldn't we admire these people, right? Now that narrative didn't win out because the problem with that is, fine, maybe you would like to do that, and you have a fantasy that you could ever be in a state that does that, and I understand that, but they're not our friends.
No.
And so if someone's like that, if someone's doing that, and they're not on your side, then why would you? You know, I guess it's only goys that ever do this thing where they have this sort of admiration for their enemy for being like an honorable enemy. Now, Israel's not an honorable enemy, first of all, but like, Jews never think like that. They don't admire.
Hell no.
They don't admire an honorable enemy that at least puts up a good fight and is like, they just want to destroy you. They just want to crush you.
That's a uniquely white thing.
That's a uniquely white thing, and it's why.
Which is actually not something, by the way, it's not to say that we should stop being that way.
Well, we should stop being that way.
There's a reason why Westerners are, we're always universally admired until the Jews took over the cultural institutions of ours. It's only with Jewish control in our lands that Westerners have such a bad reputation abroad. I mean, even the British Empire, which I am not a fan of personally, even then, like, you know, the institutions and so on of the British Empire in India and places like that are still very respected, even prestigious, in their culture. No one thinks that of Hollywood.
No
one thinks that of, you know,
no one thinks that of the U.S. military. Because by the time the U.S. military was the global empire, I mean, people had a lot of respect for the United States before that happened, before the United States, you know, the post-World War II era when the United States became the bipolar and now the unipolar power. People, did have respect for America, and people had an idea of an American. And Henry Ford talks about this, man, in The International Jew. He's like, there was a time. Now that was in the 20s. He's like, there was a time when people had a reputation. Americans had a reputation abroad as being straight shooters. Look you in the eye, shake your hand, square deal, you know. That was the reputation. And that's gone. People now think that we're like duplicitous liars.
People now think that we are not just duplicitous liars, which they think we're like faggots. Like, no joke. Like, they think the American went from being the cowboy who makes a deal with a handshake and keeps to it, to a hysterical, violent, dishonest homosexual.
And it's also fat and in like a wheelchair at Walmart.
Right. You know, that is not innate. That's not innate to who we are. And, you know, it's not innate to the West. And I think that, you know, a lot of some of these foreign countries like the Chinese and stuff, like they still admire whites on a cultural level, like, you know, things like Bach and Beethoven and things like that. Like, those things are more popular in China now than probably they are in the West.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, yeah. But, you know, back to the promotion of Zionism in the media, how they're desperate to bring it back to, you know, bring right-wing support back to it. So we got this news about the deal Fox and Disney did, where it's officially public now. Now Fox News is its own company. Disney has bought all of the properties, all the famous properties like The Simpsons and so on. National Geographic is now going to Disney. FX is going to Disney. Guess what? What did Disney do to we'll get to Fox News in a second, but what did Disney do to Star Wars when they took over that property? You know, so you're going to get now woke Simpsons and woke Family Guy and you know, they're just going to all play the same tune with different instruments now, the same anti-white tune that Star Wars and others were playing. So this is very bad. Oh, and not to mention, I think Fox is going to keep the NFL rights, and they're going to keep the wrestling rights. So the goy feed, the real direct Goy feed is going to stay in Murdoch's hands. But
well, I know it looks like they, because there was a thing when the Murdoch Empire in the early 10s had like split off Fox, 20th Century Fox, which is all the Hollywood stuff, yeah, and News Corp, which was the news oriented stuff. It looks like now they're further splitting. News Corp, I don't even know if that's even a thing. There's now Fox Corp, and that's Fox News and like a few other media properties that is going to be, that's where the, you know, they're not going to have any control.
It's going to be Wall Street Journal, New York Post, and Times of London, plus Fox News.
Yeah, and that used to be under the News Corp and the Dow Jones, the aegis of News Corp, Dow Jones. Now it's just going to be Fox Corp is what it's going to be called, and it's going to be a standalone company. Of course, Paul Ryan is on the board of this.
Yeah, he just got appointed now, and it coincides with Fox's new spinoff company going public on the stock market as its own thing.
Yes.
That's clearly to attract investment, and it's also a very bad sign for Tucker Carlson, even Laura Ingraham. Now, I don't want to say too much, but I actually know someone that used to work at Fox, and they knew that Rupert Murdoch's son, Lachlan, who's now going to be the full CEO of this new company, is all about the money. And Rupert Murdoch is too, to an extent, but he actually is a little more principled. So apparently when some of the boycotts were taking off against Tucker, Rupert Murdoch personally intervenes to protect these people from firing.
Right.
Because he doesn't want to give in to them. Lachlan Murdoch, not so
give
much.
A shit.
So by this time next year, expect Ben Shapiro to be in Tucker Carlson's seat.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the thing is this, it's like Rupert Murdoch, there's a lot of criticisms of him, and he's this big scumbag in a lot of ways. The guy's a very huge Zionist, and he's on the board of Genie Energy, which is this company. You know, we talked about that with we had Partisan Girl on. It's this company that all these American neocons are using to exploit the illegally gotten energy resources in the Golan Heights. And, you know, of course, it's got all like Dick Cheney, Larry Summers, and all these people are on the board, and Rupert Murdoch is right there as well. So he's unprincipled in that way, but he doesn't really like leftists. And so he doesn't like the nature of the witch hunts against Tucker Carlson. So I guess there is some principle there if he's personally intervening for Tucker. But yes, I don't think that this split off of this smaller company that's only going to have a few of these media properties, and these media properties are essentially going to be the official not leftist media, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like these are going to set the tone for the conservative media, what conservatives are supposed to think is going to be governed by
Right. These
few properties, what? Like Wall Street Journal and Fox News, New York Post, etc. That's going to be it, and anything else is going to be not totally, you know, anything else will be all
remember,
the same.
Remember,
MSNBC,
the CNN difference show. The difference between the left and right in America is that the left is the product of academics and NGOs and actually to some extent like actually kind of smart people, that they're cynical, they have bad intentions, but they are smart. Meanwhile, the discourse of the right is the product of TV show pundits, like they're the cable news people. Those are the people that set the tone of what conservatism is. That's why, you know, conservatism transforms every year, depending on who's on TV. So this move with Paul Ryan at the helm, I mean, Paul going, this is clearly not because Paul Ryan has some kind of
no, it's his business
link
acumen
to the people. He doesn't have a fucking
no. You don't understand. It's the market deciding.
Yeah.
This guy's business acumen is tremendous. Like, he's just a keen eye for the markets. He knows how to give the people what they want. He can judge these things and the supply and demand curves. You know, is this the market deciding?
Yeah. So the fact that Paul Ryan is on board is really a bad sign for Fox. And Fox in general sucks balls anyway. It's just like one or two shows.
Anything other than Tucker is just crap.
Trash. Yeah, it's just trash.
I mean, there was, if you were really into like defending Trump from the Mueller probe, maybe you like could watch Hannity or something like that, but Hannity, it's just like, whatever. I mean, people were always like, why are they not taking on Hannity? And it's like, because Hannity's out there every day pushing back on this deep state. And it's like, well, as it turned out, that shit was all kabuki theater.
Well, Hannity, if you want to get the CEO summary of your nightly Hannity hour, just read a White House press release on something. I mean, that's really all it is. It's just that that is actually, you know, ironically, they called Tucker Carlson a Trump shill, but actually Tucker has actually been probably one of the most critical people aside from Ann Coulter of Trump. It's guys like Hannity that are the state, if they want to call it that, state-owned media or whatever. And that's only if you pretend that the president is the state, which it's not. But yeah, Hannity is totally worthless. He'll stay on for indefinitely.
No, Hannity's not, his job is not in any trouble. But the other thing is that it's like, Tucker doesn't even really talk that much about Trump.
No.
I mean, that's one of the kind of shifts is that the people that are offering you something different to think about and talk about, they're not really covering Trump very much. Because what's to say?
Yeah. Not just that, but Tucker also starts debates that they don't want to have.
They don't want to have the debates.
So they don't like Tucker bringing up, hey, does diversity work in a marriage? Does diversity work in a school?
Yeah, that's verboten. That's it's like, yeah.
You're not supposed to debate those things. In fact, you're not even supposed to debate whether we should invade Syria or the Ukraine or whatever, or Venezuela. I'm not sure what his take on the last one was, but I don't know. But
he didn't really talk about it. I mean,
yeah. Another thing he didn't talk about was Ilhan Omar.
Yeah, well that's why. I mean, my opinion is that was the last straw, they finally did this gay op on him.
I'll tell you what, everyone. So notice the timing of these gay ops, Media Matters, which of course is entirely funded by Zionists. So the last time this happened to Tucker, the last big push to boycott, they claimed that they were just really offended by the fact that Tucker Carlson said illegal aliens litter. Just a day before that, Tucker Carlson was talking about Israel's wall and starting a very uncomfortable debate about that because he was saying, well, why is it all these Democrats that are against Donald Trump's wall on moral grounds are all for Israel's wall? That's not a debate they want to have.
No.
Because because whenever he would bring that up to like the token liberal that he would bring on his show, like the DNC operative.
They would be thunderstruck.
They would be like Donald Trump, like, I don't know what I said. I don't remember. They'd be potatoes.
Yeah. No, they would sit there thunderstruck. It was hilarious. And then
a few days later, the boycott started. Now this time, notice the timing here. The allegation is Tucker said something naughty like 20 years ago or 10 years ago. But really what it is Tucker Carlson during the Ilhan Omar thing was saying nothing about deafening silence. And on top of that, bringing Michael Tracy on for unrelated things. But while Michael Tracy was going out there basically leading the left wing push to support Omar against Zionism, Michael Tracy's on Twitter right now asking Ben Shapiro about his Jewish identity politics and also defending whites by Michael Tracy's defending whites by name, saying that Yang's right to call them whites by name because whites are suffering in this country. So what I'm saying here is that the timing there is something that, again, the only two people that know what's going on in this country, Jews and Nazis, both saw what was going on there.
Yeah.
And that's what really triggered this boycott, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, there's always some other way that he's like, you know, and the perpetually offended. It's like, you know, the grug brain leftists, like the hysterical cat ladies and the moronic, you know, progressive dads and the soy boys, they can be marshaled in these outrage campaigns. You know, racism. Yeah. Oh my God. Pedophilia, like you're whatever the moral panic they want to, you know, of course they're not going to point the fingers at the, you know, in terms of pedophilia, there's a conversation they definitely don't want to
imagine.
Have.
Imagine Salon.com writing these breathless, angry.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, you could so easily just go back through, like they literally hosted I'm a pedophile, not a monster, which is an actual apologia for pedophiles.
An actual person like a literal, that talks about like, wanting to molest yes, 5-year-old
yeah,
children.
A literal person that says, yes, I want to have sex with children. Oh, God, please do not ever isolate
don't
that
judge
clip,
me.
Anybody. But like, yeah. Yeah, no, an actual person that says that, writing a column defending himself as not a monster, just somebody who's born that way in the pages of Salon and Slate. And then, you know, now they're doing a moral panic because Tucker, you know, made a joke about Miss Teen USA pageant. Yeah. And it's like, all right. I mean, we don't even need to really, you know, yeah, like we don't even really need. And meanwhile, Howard Stern makes these jokes every fucking day.
And lots of famous people that go on Howard Stern
yeah,
make these
yeah,
jokes.
A lot. There's plenty of people that make jokes like this.
I remember when they were trying to use that Donald Trump's appearance on Howard Stern. They were trying to use that against him. I think it was actually about the Iraq War, but he was also saying some like dirty old man stuff or whatever. The thing is that like at this point, those tactics don't work because one, the evangelical element on the right that is kind of prone to that those types of purity spirals, mm-hmm. like they're kind of irrelevant now and they're dependent on secular right wingers to just stay afloat, frankly. And second of all, people see through those tricks. They see that the rules you put out for other people don't apply to you. So now you're going to have a society where no one apologizes for anything. You know, like Tucker said, actually, there's nothing wrong with apologizing for, you know, doing something wrong, right? Like, for example, he apologized the other day for helping accuse Gary Condit of murder. Remember that,
yeah.
You know,
that was actually, yeah.
He was part of that and he's very sorry. He ruined this man's life and he was an innocent man. He did all this fake news. But, you know, so apologizing is a good thing. It's a sign of a man that can learn from his errors and so on. But if you're going to apologize to people who are fundamentally amoral and Machiavellian, who are just trying to get you to apologize as a form of a confession to something, don't do it. And that's the society we're going to get now. People saw what Donald Trump did in 2006. He didn't apologize for anything, and he won. So that's going to be the new standard.
Yeah. Gary Condit thing is actually kind of interesting because that was, you know, people always talk about the left circling the wagons and helping their own. They didn't do that with him.
No.
They threw that guy directly under the bus. And, you know, he was banging Chandra Levy, I believe, but then she was just killed by like an illegal immigrant.
Yeah.
Man, and then it was like, oh, well, okay. All right. You know,
they're all accusing him. But anyway, you know, you see something similar with Morris Deese. Like, Morris Deese is actually not apologizing.
That guy's an actual fucking pervert.
Yeah.
That guy's a filthy pervert.
Yeah. Anyone that questions Morris Deese gets the punishment dildo. So just watch your mouth out there.
Well, I mean, it got so bad. I mean, and also this is a blow to the Morris Deese thing. We should talk about that. I mean, I think we kind of covered this other stuff, the way the media is working and the right and white nationalism. I mean, it kind of weaves together into a coherent narrative if you kind of like pull back and look at it. And I just to sort of sum up, I think that it's going to be a little bit rough to feel like the eye of Sauron is on us or, you know, looking down, breathing down our necks, but.
Yeah, behave yourselves, people. Well, I mean, really.
Look, all I'm saying is all we had to do is just not back down and say, no, we are not doing anything wrong. We are standing up for people that don't really have a voice and right. We are not breaking laws. We are well within our constitutional rights with everything we do. I don't call for violence. I don't advocate violence. I am out here.
I go
saying,
out of my way to oppose gratuitous violence and shootings and things like that all the time.
Yeah. And so,
you can't hang anything on me because and if you try to hang something on me, then you're just coming after me for my politics.
Okay. Yeah, it's not something I support. It's not something I would support. And, you know, I'm against it. And this is where we are. This is political. We engage in speech and we are trying to, wake people up to the reality of the political situation. And if you come after me for that, well, you know, you're the bad guy. You're the piece of shit. You're the one that's going against the American tradition. You're the one that's going against the Constitution. If you want to shut me down, I mean, maybe it'll happen. I don't know, but I'm going to fight.
I was,
Unjustified grounds. Yes, good.
Let me actually read you a quote from Christopher Lash. So, yeah, I've been really obsessively reading this guy. He's criminally underrated. He has a small following on the left as well as the right. This man was essentially probably the most important thing, even adjacent to third positionism in America in the post-war era, in my opinion. Him and Yockey. In fact, some of his critiques of liberalism and American society and the ongoings of the 60s and so on sound remarkably a lot like Yockey, Francis Parker Yockey. But this is his view on the left, which is very, very prescient. He's talking about the left under Reagan, which apparently had a moment of derangement syndrome, nothing like Trump now. But whatever, what he's saying here is actually remarkably similar. So this is the quote. It says, "The experience of adversity under Reagan has intensified the demand for ideological conformity on the left and thus encouraged this kind of thinking, always appealing to those insecure people who yearn for the excitement of taking sides in the eternal struggle between the forces of progress and the forces of, quote, regression, quote, which side are you on, boys?" That's a reference to the famous Miner song, the folk song. "When the sides were more clearly drawn, the question made sense." So he's praising the Miners, the striking Miners in that song there. But then he continues. It says, "It still makes sense if it means people who profess a disinterested love of truth and justice ought to be skeptical, on principle, of the claims of wealth and power and predisposed to side with the underdog. But the left long ago lost any vivid interest in underdogs. It is allergic to anything that looks like a lost cause. Such moral authority as the left enjoyed in the past derived from its identification with the oppressed. But its appeal to intellectuals, unfortunately, has usually rested on its claims to stand on the side of history and progress. What added to the thrill of choosing sides was the certainty that in socialism, one chose the winning side, the, quote, cooperative commonwealth, sure to prevail in the long run. The only morally defensible choice, however, is the choice of mercy, charity, and forgiveness over the world's principalities and powers, the choice of truth against ideology. To make that choice today means to reject left and right alike." So that is, like, very prescient of a third position. Of course, Mr. Lash was very well respected. He had a very popular book, but he kind of fell down the rabbit hole. He died relatively young in his 60s. He died in 1994. He actually, his best book by far, which I recommend everyone would read, is Revolt of the Elites, which is a play on Jose Ortega Gasset's Revolt of the Masses. And, you know, there is a little bit of, you know, he doesn't say anything much about Jews or anything like that, obviously, but he does talk about academics.
Yeah, well, you can read between the lines there if you Revolt of the Elites and you're talking, I've seen this actually in some other writings of people that don't directly talk about the JQ, where they do talk about this 20th century phenomena. Well, they located the 20th century. Some people might locate it a little bit earlier, of elites, turning on their people. Mm-hmm. And, there's arguable when that happened, right? Like, people could give random dates or events or whatever, but it's a phenomena that became clear over time that now the elites just hate the people, right? And this is quite clear in the attitudes that they express. And this is something that is, there was probably always an element of like looking down your nose, but right. This is something new, right? Like, this is something visceral and really just like, even if you look down your nose at the plebs, you understood like they were vital to the power structure to keep them, happy on some level. Now it's like, this is, and I would argue that when you see this phenomena and you don't connect it to the Jewish question, which is the answer, this is why it's happening.
Yeah.
That
because the elite aren't you.
Because they're not us, and ultimately their agenda. Because it's like I was having this conversation with people, relative to this, even with this latest shooting event, and people saying like, how can they not see that this is not sustainable? This is not tenable. What they are setting up, like the situation they're setting up, is one of disintegration, literally in the actual sense of the word, not necessarily like collapse or something, but disintegration. Like the United States is not going to be an integrated country. It is disintegrated. People are not integrating.
One thing Christopher Lash brings up in Revolt of the Elites is, he talks about identity politics, not in the gay conservative way, but he talks about it from a kind of objective, detached way, where he says, like, for example, even in the 90s, the biggest debate in academia was reason and truth itself. Like, for example, the big push from Jews in academia was to,
undermine the concept.
Pigeonhole. Well, yeah, they pigeonhole Plato or Aristotle, whatever, as old white men.
Yes.
Dead
yeah,
white
they,
men
they, yeah, they would
who
they
have. Would. Racial hidden racial biases, and so these guys should never be deferred to reason. So his argument is that, well, if we're going to have a multicultural society and no one can even agree with what the truth is, how can we possibly make this work? Like, yeah. How can this possibly function if no one can even agree what the first principles of reality or history or philosophy or anything are?
Yeah.
Like, this is just nothing but irreconcilable divisions. And this is why we see a lot of violence going on, and frankly, you know, dystopian violence across the board between different groups, you know, all kinds of horrible and gratuitous violence. And it ultimately comes down back to the Jew that deconstructs reason, deconstructs truth, and creates this, you know, I think Parrott said it. Parrott always has really good one-liners. He said they put all the different animals in the pet shop in the same cage and watch them fight. You know, so this is, this is very important to understand that Christopher Lash was predicting all the way, unlike Cernovich, his predictions came true. He's predicting this in the early 90s. He saw this, starting to take hold in Harvard, Yale, and so on, where Jews cheat to get in and push their lies. And he's saying that, you know, if you're a white male, if you're a white heterosexual male and you say something that's true, these forces will discredit you based on who you are. They characterize you as implicitly racist and agenda ridden. And really, that's just projection, because they're the racists, and they're the not the DR3, but the Jews are the real racists.
Well, they're the real
JR3, and they're the ones that have the hidden agenda.
Well, they're the real supremacists. I mean, let's be honest. Yeah. The claims of them when they say white nationalists are racial supremacists, white supremacists. They want to. I mean, they say things that they're like, these are people that want to like kill every other race. It's like, well, it's not true. You know, like you, that is, I mean, maybe there's some like spurgy guy on the chans that will like, that's reacting to everything in a bad way and saying stupid shit, but that's what they want everyone to think you are, when there's a much more intellectual component to all this. But yeah, the thing with the Aristotle and them locating that, and this is the thing, I mean, this is something that started to be seen, and, where they were like, oh, look, his idea of logic and reason is like a white thing. And it's sort of like, all right, well, people argue against that from the perspective of, no, he discovered eternal principles, or Plato discovered eternal principles, or at least
that's the idea.
Yeah. And it's like, my thing is like, well, look, you might even have a point, that these, this method, this reasoning method, this logical, you know, deductive reasoning or you know, empirical reasoning, you know, depending, you want to go Plato, Aristotle, whatever, or the debate between the two, or whatever it is, like, you might have a point that this is a Western thing, that this is a white thing. But if so, this is a grounding principle of our society, and you're undermining it, you're attacking it. And if we can't have that, what's your grounding principle? This is, I mean, exactly what Christopher Lash was saying. We can't do it. And you even actually see this now in something that Andrew Yang was saying. Yeah. Andrew Yang was saying something along the lines of, as far as fake news, he's talking about fake news, right? Because everyone's saying, like, you know, everyone thinks the other guy's news is the fake news, right?
Yeah.
And he was saying, well, the problem with fake news is that we can't have an agreed upon set of facts that we work from. And it's like, yeah, we can't. And that's because, you know, it's like, there's always going to be, you know, there's always going to be a range of debate in a white society. There's always going to be.
And even antagonism.
There's but there's
classes and whatever. But the problem with Jews is that whatever natural antagonisms exist, they introduce more and more and more.
Yes.
Ever more.
But they've introduced the idea.
Antagonized against their parents. You have men antagonizing with women and vice versa. So their master plan is pure subversion, which is to keep everyone fighting against everyone.
Yeah. And the idea of discrediting of literally like an, you know, and it's funny. It's like something that Aristotle literally calls out as something you can't do, which is like just attack the person rather than the argument, which is like
all
like,
they do.
It's all that they do.
What they do with us.
Yeah.
They never interact with anything we argue for, any of our intellectual critiques or anything. They just try to characterize us.
And that's like that's so clear in the case of people that they're just totally against. But yeah, I mean, that whole, there is no truth and logic and those things are fundamentally white and they're teaching people this. And they're teaching people to, so what do you do against that? Like my challenge to conservatives is, what do you do? Because if you're coming back at them and you're like, no, look, if we reason from first principles and we discover but you can't, that's, you're doing that because you're white. What do you say to that?
Yeah, exactly.
You
make that argument and they're like, no, I'm not going to listen to you because of who you are.
So what do you say to these people? You can't say anything. The only thing you can say is, all right, well, you know what? Like, you're actually now fundamentally like a threat to my society because you're doing that. Like, because you're doing that, you're actually somebody that I need to keep you away. Because I can't function with people like
you around. I'm famous for being an anti-imperialist, and I still am. I think the imperial project was bad in many ways. But, you know, we actually have seen the world under white supremacy, and the vast majority of people that lived under it, whether it was the Spanish Empire, the British Empire, whatever, the black and colored people that lived under it, actually their life expectancies got longer. And their living standards got higher.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that, you know, it was all good or it was perfect. Like, that's another problem that.
Well, oftentimes this happened at the expense of.
It wasn't the monstrous genocidal thing.
No, that's
that
a lie.
They say it is either.
No, it certainly wasn't. And certainly when, I mean, look, like, if this is a point that people make and a lot of people don't want to hear it, but a lot of times black slaves oftentimes had it better than poor whites in the South. I mean, and Ryan Falk actually did a whole thing on this where he's like, you can tell this by the relative heights because little do people know, black people are actually a little bit shorter on average than whites in America. It's not something that's reflected in the NBA, but there's greater variation. But the point is, at that time in the South, blacks were taller.
Yeah.
They were better fed. There were poor white people that were malnourished, very poor, couldn't find work, very oppressed. And so, you know, that's one of the other problems with, it's like, you know, that's one of my main critiques of that slave system. There's other critiques. I mean, certainly you could critique it from the perspective of the blacks as well, that this is an immoral thing to do. But, the white supremacy thing.
Yeah. That was a big debate that the more, puritanical, like say the Anglo-Puritan types that were behind the abolitionist movement, they were very, like, you know, I'm not saying what they were doing was wrong. I mean, I do agree. I'm against slavery. I'm not saying anything controversial by saying I'm against slavery. But one thing that they were kind of hypocritical about was exactly what you're saying, because a lot of these people also held classical liberal views on economics and factory work and stuff. So really, the argument against slavery could have easily been made against industrial capitalism in the 18th century.
Well, that's the other thing.
And those people just didn't want to hear it. The abolitionists did not want to hear it. And their explanation for the difference was some technicality based on abstractions that don't exist about individual rights and so on.
That's the thing. I mean,
it's really the same argument conservatives make today, that it's somehow different if the censor is private versus public.
Right.
If the government shuts down your newspaper, that's somehow worse than if private capitalists shut down your newspaper, yeah, which is if private capitalists
buy up every media, if like a few, you know, and this is something the left used to raise alarm bells about was media conglomeration. If a few, you know, corporations or conglomerates buy up all the airwaves and shut down anything dissenting, how is that any different than if the government is out there, than if the USSR is out there just like shutting down people? It's ultimately like, objectively the conditions are the same, effectively. So why then based on an abstraction, it doesn't matter. Yes. I mean, they would like, look, conditions for white people and even children in the 1870s in America were terrible. Objectively awful.
Children
conditions.
Used to work in factories 18 hours a day.
And they would like lose fingers and shit. They would
lose their arms.
And there would be fires and their horrible people get maimed and die in these horrible accidents. It was terrible. It was very bad.
Guess
but
what?
They were
got
free.
On the
but Stryker, they were
no...
free.
Yeah.
They were free people though.
The children that got injured on the job, they would be thrown out into the street with no compensation.
But they were free.
To beg. Yeah.
But they weren't oppressed.
The freedom. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, so, look, ridiculous. which is not too, but again, there's, you know, you don't want to go too far.
It's not
in that
to downplay
direction.
Slavery. No, it's not to downplay slavery. It was wrong. But, you know,
it's also not to downplay the concept of freedom, but like freedom,
right.
You know, freedom is not like being
freedom's
chained
mad
to,
gay.
But it's like the idea of it, you're not free. Those people were not free. Those people were not enjoying, you know, some kind of liberated existence. Okay. So like, you know, let's be honest. And this is a point that the left has always kind of made, depending on who is making it. But now it's like, now you see, you know, the new left, the corporate, the neo-corporate, the neoliberal left, which has been like totally subsumed the old left, which used to make these kind of arguments, where now you have the IWW. Like actively supporting FBI clampdowns on free speech. You know, it's insane.
It's not that they're actively supporting it for pragmatic reasons. That would be even a little understandable. They're going out of their way. It's fucking cringe, man. They're going out of their way to say, oh, look at this ridiculous FBI document. It's fire.
It's lit, yo.
I can't even believe, like, just fucking
yo,
makes me just sick.
That FBI
it's
indictment fire. Is lit, dog.
Yo. You gotta see this FBI document, nigga.
Yeah.
Yo. You know,
yo, that affidavit, that shit's off the chain, brah.
Damn. Savage. Savage.
Yeah,
you know, like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It just fucking pisses me off because it's so just, unprincipled.
It's like, it's also fake. It's like, it's just like, yeah, it's unbelievably unprincipled. And yeah, I mean, it's so degraded.
It goes back to, but it really just encapsulates, and this is something we always stress here. And some people don't understand because it is a little confusing. But, you know, the real problem between left and right is that the left, like Christopher Lash says, understands on some level that the machines, the mechanisms of power are going in the direction they're pushing them in already. The momentum is on their side. That's why they're always talking about being on the right side of history. Yeah. So for them, they understand doing what they do as a kind of low risk, high reward endeavor.
Yeah.
Right. So even if they publicly signal as underdogs, they have an intuitive and visceral understanding that the corporations, the media, the government, they're all on their side. They just need to be dragged a little bit.
Yeah.
But with the right, on the other hand, first of all, right wingers don't think about these things too deeply. That's the first problem. But the second is the addiction to Hobbesian, Nietzschean type of thinking, where you simply can't even fathom that you're an underdog. But what happens when you're outnumbered? What happens when you have no rights? What happens when you have no representatives or advocates? What happens when you have no media? There's no newspaper out there or TV channel that represents these views, even though there's plenty of us. There's definitely more people interested in what me and Mike or other people have to say than there is in the Weekly Standard. Or in Ben Shapiro. There's more organic interest. But we don't have any of that. So guess what? The right turns out to be underdogs who think as Ubermensch, which it might look cool in your head, but in practice, it's just a barking chihuahua that someone kicks. Like, that's really... I hate to say it's a hard truth to swallow.
It's a tough thing to swallow. And it's like, and it's a... It's which is like... And I totally get why you would not want to understand yourself as the underdog and the, you know, the Nietzschean attack on slave morality and all that, blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying be like a slave moralist, but just understand the reality of the situation.
And like, adapt.
Yeah. And, you know, there's, we just have to be, I think, honestly, I think just like, and this is just something I've been thinking about. Like, I don't want to do things anymore where I like take strategic, like I overly strategize about, oh, narrative. I just going to tell you what the fucking truth.
Yeah.
Like, cause there's no reason not to do it. Like, there's nothing I want to say and think. And I'm not going to appeal to people because they, you know, certain elements or tendencies because I might get pushed, but I'm just going to tell people what I think. And yeah, this is just how it is. I'm just telling you the truth. This is as I see it. If I get something wrong, I'll correct it. But, you know, there's no point in like the truth is the best thing to do. Lies are the worst thing that there are. And I mean, there's worse things than that, but you know, ultimately yeah, lies lead to even worse things. So that's just what it is. Like, we have to just be out here telling the truth. And, you know, if they're going to do something against us, then we have to, the only weapon that we fight back with is the truth. I don't know a better approach, unfortunately.
Yeah. I don't know what else to do. I mean, maybe we can, you know, I mean, yeah, that, I second what you said. So, let's talk about the Southern. Okay. Go
ahead. Let's take a break. We were talking, yeah, like a half hour ago, we said we were going to talk about Moore's D's, but I gotta yeah, take a piss.
Moore's D's nuts.
Yeah. I gotta go empty my bladder. So let's,
gotcha, me too.
Let's take a break and we'll come back and talk about Moore's D's.
Ready? Let's all do right, it. Bye bye. Hello. Yo. Yeah, nigga. What? Yeah, motherfucker. Yep.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So let me know when you're ready to go.
I'm ready to rock and roll, baby.
All right, so we're back. So we're going to talk about this Moore's D's.
Yes.
So Moore's D's, founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, was dismissed, fired last week from his job as, I guess, president or whatever, top dog. I don't know what his official title was, but he was the founder. Only non-Jew, really, in a top position there. But also, the other thing about it is that you know, he's, this guy's a pervert. There's really no other way to put it.
I know, like, I think it's convincing that this is some kind of sexual thing, and they have been hinting at that, but I think there might be some financial improprieties at play. I think there might be. I also think that some of the blacks at the Southern Poverty Law Center are resentful that they work in a building in a 70% black city, Montgomery, Alabama, and yet all the top paid employees are Jews or
well, they whites. See them as, well, they say they're whites. Now, this is all true. And so there's a number of internal conflicts in the Southern Poverty Law Center. And the thing is, it's been known for decades that Moore's D's is a pervert.
Yeah.
It's been known since the 70s. There are court documents going back to the 70s. Talking about him attempting to, you know, peeping on his 18-year-old stepdaughter. Of course, I think he probably was doing it before she was 18, but, you know, they didn't want to introduce different kind, you know, whatever. They said peeping on her, trying to use a dildo, buying her a dildo for her 18th birthday and trying to use it on her. Now this was like 30 years ago. Having sex with the wives of other, you know, wealthy people that would come to party with them. You know, inducing his wife into a threesome with a homosexual man. He then, like, this is all in court documents that you can see.
Yeah.
So it's been known. And of course, I'm sure that he was sexually abusing people. But as you said, one, there's a lot of questions about the finances of the SPLC. One, it's like their war chest grows every year, and they got a huge windfall since Charlottesville. Their money, their cash on hand went up by like $100 million since then.
Yeah.
And what are they doing with that? And then on top of that, it's like, there's also the issue of race within the SPLC. So yes, you have.
Remember, because because of various protections they have, they don't have to disclose a lot of things in their finances. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, they're defending off a bunch of lawsuits, and you know they have a clean slate so far. But these lawsuits are getting more and more sophisticated.
Yeah.
So they might be trying to clean house before, you know, just in case any of these lawsuits get through.
It's entirely possible because, you know, a motion to dismiss filed by the SPLC, no lawsuit has survived it. They always get the cases against them dismissed because they've been sued a number of times, and it's always dismissed on First Amendment grounds. They always say this is a defamation claim, and we are simply exercising our free speech rights to call this person, you know, hate. Because a number of people have said, by calling me a hate group, you're defaming me. A hate person, you know, a hater, a neo-Nazi, or hate group, you're defaming my organization and causing me damages. And then they're like, well, First Amendment. And the courts always accept that argument. But the arguments are getting more sophisticated. These lawsuits that they're up against now are more significantly more sophisticated. And they're also calling out other improprieties of theirs, like their 501c3 status essentially being a sham. The idea that they don't engage in political advocacy is bullshit. You know, they were clearly in the tank for Hillary Clinton. Obviously so. And you're not supposed to do that as a 501c3.
They're also using the massive financial advantage they have over right-wing groups to get them deplatformed and increase that financial advantage. So, yeah. You know, another thing, too, is that they hardly do anything on the civil rights front. Like, you know, you see them doing like a token lawsuit for prison reform or something occasionally. Most of their resources are spent on, you know, shutting down enemies of Jews, specifically Jews. And that's because the Southern Poverty Law Center is not even a pro-black organization. It's a Zionist organization. Let me just read you. So these are the board members. OK, so there's there's 14 members of the board. And I'm just going by the people with Jewish last names. Some of these might be half Jews and we don't even know it. Pam Horowitz.
Oh, God.
Howard Mandel.
Oh, my God.
Another Howie Mandel. Eldon Rosenthal.
Maybe it's the same one.
Eldon Rosenthal. Lita Orzek. Joseph Levin. Ellen Sudo, Marsha Levick. You see the pattern here, people? These are not, black activists or anything. They have a token black as the chairman, actually, but that's clearly a political choice they're making. But yeah. The point I'm making here is that their highest paid employees are all Jewish and with the occasional white. I believe Heidi Barak is white.
Heidi Barak is white. Morris Dees is white. But Morris Dees, his middle name is like Seligman or something like that. Because
And he used to play that. He used to brag about that.
He would say like he was actually a token Jew because his father had a friend of his father's was a Jew, and that was his namesake, and so he's spiritually, one of them. And
you know, the reason the SPLC is a Zionist organization under Morris Dees's helmsmanship with Levin, part of it was Levin's influence, obviously, but the principal reason why Morris Dees took it in the direction it's going in now is because Jews are the ones that give you money. Blacks don't give you money. It's Jews. So this is essentially a Zionist enforcement organization, not that different from the ATL, that is masking itself as a anti-racist organization. But yeah. Blacks inside of the organization, apparently, judging from the LA Times, actually published parts of a letter. They didn't publish the whole thing, of course, because that would actually give us an idea of what's going on. So they only quoted selective parts of it, but the general tone of the letter is that blacks are essentially kept out of positions of influence.
Yeah, I think it's possible that some of the blacks see what's going on. Some of them maybe don't. You know, what blacks know about the difference between Jews and whites, I don't know. I think it varies. But they are, it's what they're seeing is Jewish nepotism. What they are seeing is Jews have, and for the Jews, a lot of times it's like, this is what they do. Like, why would they do anything different? Like, and they don't, you know, they've always done this. And the relationship with Jews and blacks is an interesting thing. And yeah, it's very easy for that, for the Southern Poverty Law Center to just make token call outs of somebody. Oh, here's the guy who said a racist thing. This guy's racist. Look at this racist.
Did they defend Ilhan Omar during the, when she criticized AIPAC?
Absolutely not. And a lot of the attacks on her were racist. They went into a racist element. Like I was saying, that's the other thing. Like Tucker Carlson was called out because he said a racist thing about Arabs like 12 years ago when that was being promoted by the Zionist media.
Yeah.
When you were allowed to say that, because again, and there's other remnants of people being allowed to say those kinds of things that we're seeing today. So
Jeanine Pirro did get punished for it,
but her comments were blatant that it was.
Yeah, she got punished for it. But I think that is kind of the Jewish olive branch to the Arabs and Muslims, because they don't want another enemy. Like they don't want, you know, in America at least. So I think that was a bit of an olive branch to
also,
I'm not sure if they fired or suspended Jeanine Pirro, but it's not because what she says matters.
There is some threat of a white self-consciousness coming out of
that too.
Seeing themselves as an other in the case of Muslims, right?
Right.
It's sort of like there is a risk of them whipping up this anti-Muslim sentiment on behalf of Zionism. There is a risk of this being a Frankenstein monster that they create that then becomes like, oh, well, now whites are starting to kind of see themselves collectively, which is something that they don't want. But, you know, yeah. So, but again, also
everything is centered around protecting the, it's not even about Muslims or anything. It's about protecting the immigration and diversity experiments.
Right. It's like the general narrative of human rights, equality, blah, 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 egalitarian. That's something that both sides of the kosher sandwich accept this. So you can't allow these sentiments through. I mean, there's a lot of Fox commentators, and this is something that liberals have complained about for a long time, and this is why they call them racist. You know, it's so funny is if, you know, when Barry Weiss goes out on Twitter and she says something about, how terrible the New Zealand shooting was. And I went and I looked at the comments on that tweet, and it was all leftists calling her a hypocrite because she's out there whipping up anti-Muslim hatred. Now, this is not something I was terribly cognizant of because I don't really follow Barry Weiss. I didn't really follow her very much until recently. But apparently, you know, these sort of more, you know, left-wing people have been seeing her, and because she's a total shill for Zionism, you know, they interpret that in that way. But of course, she's never getting censored or called out by the establishment for that. You know, it's sort of funny, and it's also very funny when you have Benjamin Netanyahu going out there and saying, "Oh, the New Zealand mosque shooting was terrible." It's like, dude,
what a cynic.
Are you fucking kidding me, guys?
What a cynic. Literally the same day, bomb like five.
The same day they're bombing Gaza. And I don't know if anybody was killed or not, but they certainly plenty of people have been killed in such actions.
No, they kill people every single day.
They kill them all the time. And so it's like, yeah, it's absurd.
You just laugh at when they do that.
Yeah,
stuff. You know, I have an article pulled up here, and it's about the Morris D's firing. And apparently there was a book by John Egerton called Shades of Gray, Dispatches from the South. It's all about the SPLC's internal politics. And it was written in the early 90s, actually. And it says here that Morris Dees wanted to continue focusing on the Southern Poverty Law Center's fights with Nazi groups and Klan groups. But the blacks on the staff wanted to use the SPLC for things like affirmative action, voting rights, criminal justice reform. So there's a big fight there, and
Advancing black interests rather than fighting with boogeymen.
Or actually, you know, say what you want. Like, listen, I disagree with affirmative action, all that, of course. But like, those are actually relevant issues that are institutional. Like, you're punching up to an extent.
Well, but it also just
more so than you are when you sue, you know, a little Ku Klux Klan group.
Well, look, that's what I'm saying. If you're black and you want to make tangible gains, it makes more sense for you to say, hey, let's sue the government for affirmative action than let's try and destroy like the NSM. Right?
Yeah. Exactly. That's what they were taught. That was the big split that caused a lot of these blacks to quit the SPLC.
But how do you bring in money from wealthy Jews? Is you say, look, there's Nazis.
Well, not just look, there's Nazis. Look, we're going to destroy these Nazis while they're small.
Yeah.
Like these Nazis that are powerless, we're going to destroy them. We're going to anticipate them and destroy them in their crib or whatever. And that's the pitch that made Mr. D's all of his money. So, so clearly this is this tension inside of the Southern Poverty Law Center is one that is specifically between Jews and the non-Jews
I have a quote from another book I wanted to read here. Now, this is Douglas Reed's Controversy of Zion. He goes over a lot of stuff in this, but this is a very interesting quote that's relevant. It's not about the SPLC specifically, but it's totally relevant. So he says this. This is a book written in between 1952 and 1956. So just think about that. Think how relevant it is. It's like the same story. The agitation about the lot of the American Negro, of which so much is heard in the outer world, is kept going from New York almost entirely by the two chief Jewish publicity organizations, the American Jewish Committee and the Anti-Defamation League, both of which dispose of large funds, and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which from its inception has been a largely Jewish-directed. The Negro himself plays a passive part in it. His wish is for better opportunities of advancement alongside the white population. He does not desire to interbreed. The energy of the Jewish organizations, which claim to intercede in his cause, is entirely directed towards a compulsory intermingling which neither race desires. Thus, the influence of these non-Negro groups was the chief one behind the litigation leading to the Supreme Court ruling of 1955, which held the existing separate school system to be illegal and ordered its abolition and compulsory mixed schooling. This judgment can hardly be enforced in the South without civil war, and has been followed by various violent episodes, including the use of the National Guard and tanks to enforce mixed schooling.
I was able to see
the American Jewish Committee's budget for 1953, the estimates for which were $1,755,000. This stated in respect to the Negroes. The status of Jews is more secure in most of the civil and political rights areas than that of some other groups, especially Negroes. But so long as a successful threat is made to the enjoyment of rights by Negroes, the rights of Jews are riskfully in balance. Accordingly, a large proportion of our work has been directed towards securing greater equalization of opportunities for such other groups rather than for ourselves. An example of this is our relationship with the NAACP, which comes to us for assistance in certain matters where we have special competence. A fruitful weapon is court action. We participate directly in litigation. We had filed briefs attacking segregation and have prepared briefs challenging discrimination against Negroes. Supreme Court is composed of political... Now, that's the end of the quote from the American Jewish Committee's text. Then the last sentence is, Supreme Court is composed of political appointees, not of professional jurists. This is an important factor in what might develop into a grave situation. So that's what he was saying about the Jewish relationship to the blacks, and it really hasn't changed very much. Except that now, like, the court actions were never directed towards actually advancing blacks. It was towards Jewish interests. And for a time, they saw the interest was to get whites and blacks intermingled and kind of treat blacks like a canary in a coal mine. Keep whitey distracted, really. And now that's like sort of an accomplished fact, and you know,
I always make the comparison of a middle manager, right? So when you go to the store, you go to one of these chain stores, like say a Walmart, and you have a problem, maybe someone ripped you off, or you got a bad product. The person that takes the brunt of your anger is the manager. Not the people that own it or the people that are responsible for bad business practices. So, like, this is kind of a similar situation, and the SPLC is especially dishonest because it masquerades as a non-Jewish organization, something that the ADL can't do.
But it's also why the SPLC is actually something that is hated by the conservative right. Now, if you want to talk about...
That's why they feel...
If you want to talk about times when we can use the hatred of the conservative right to a beneficial purpose. This is one of those times where because the SPLC has been so blatant and they become anti-Christian. How does that help black people? How does the Family Research Council in any way help blacks? Like, how does going against
black people, there's probably a higher
they probably sympathize with their views
that agree with their views than there are whites even.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but I would say certainly religious black people, Christian blacks, which, you know, most blacks are just a-religious, but those that are religious are totally in line with the Family Research Council's views on stuff, you know. Yeah. So
here's an interesting piece of trivia on Morris Deese. So this book by John Egerton came out in September 1991, but this is just a few months. So they must have gotten tipped off that he was writing this book, because in that year, in January, they made a movie called Line of Fire, the Morris Deese story.
Oh, geez.
It was a made-for-TV movie dramatizing Morris Deese's glorious defeat of the Ku Klux Klan. And the movie was written by James Heisch.
Oh, God.
And Charles Rosen.
Oh, my God.
So clearly, these were the people setting the propaganda table to keep Morris Deese in this direction, while they probably got a tip that someone was writing a book about or maybe this was just an ongoing dispute inside of the SPLC where they wanted to focus on institutional issues rather than on picking on, you know, some whites that live in Mississippi and have no money or power.
Right.
You know, so this is very interesting that this came out in the same year. And this is definitely propaganda to support the Morris Deese the direction Morris Deese wanted to keep the SPLC. Well,
also, think about agitation that blacks do when they're not totally being directed by Jews. What they ask for things like reparations. They literally are just give us a bunch of money, right? Yeah. Like, and that's the reparations thing. That's why I don't even bother with it. First of all, Yang Gang, yes, definitely, but like I don't even bother going after, because it's not going to happen, because it's what's not really a threat to blacks is like white nationalism, frankly. Like, we don't even really talk about them very much.
Not that much.
No. It's not that big of
a deal. It's just like, you know, the crime issues.
Yeah,
really,
it's the issue of crime and the issue that white people should be allowed to defend themselves from crime and from attacks.
And have their own institutions.
And shouldn't be forced to integrate blacks into their institutions. But it's something that blacks used to accept.
Yeah,
and actually agree with. They used to have their own. They used to have their own elites that agreed with that.
Mm-hmm.
And like Marcus Garvey and Madison Grant were able to agree on things.
Right.
So, you know, that's until the Jew got involved and then said, no, you.
But the NAACP didn't agree with either. It's kind of like the Elliot Rodgers effect. I consent. I consent. I don't consent. That's the Jew in the corner.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's like, yes, Elliot Roger does not consent between the relationship between Chad and Stacey. He does not, you know.
Yeah, but it's literally what happened. That you can really summarize what went on during the 1960s, why the MLK wing won out and not the Malcolm X wing of the black nationalist movement is frankly because of Jews.
I mean, yeah, that's ultimately what prevails. So the FBI spends a ton of resources going after, you know, in supposedly the name of black people.
Yeah.
A ton of millions of dollars going after, you know, a bunch of guys that went to protests and got jumped and had fistfights. They spent millions on this, right? And they're now convening a congressional committee to investigate. Now, certainly that was probably also spurred by the shooting in New Zealand, which is, again, a product of exactly this phenomena of, as you said, putting all the animals in the zoo in one cage and seeing what happens. You know, and so it's like, what investigation do you need to have? We can tell you right now what happened. Like, we all know. So they're doing that. But meanwhile, you got blacks out here, they've been talking about reparations forever, and it's just a joke. It's just a joke. Now, not to say that there aren't ways that, you know, and oftentimes, like, I think that, you know, when people are really I understand when people kind of like don't like black people very much. If you just don't really like them, that's kind of just a
natural. No, if you have to live, it's one thing if you have to live around them.
If you have to live around them, it's a natural reaction.
Totally get it.
And they feel the same way about you generally, but also understand that like, you know, they are used mostly, they are deployed as like a weapon against whites. So when we talk about academia, institutional control, blacks and affirmative action, even though they always say, despite affirmative action being in place, we're not really benefiting from it. Well, one of the reasons is because they're just there to take up seats so whitey can't take them. They don't really get to, and the SPLC is like the perfect example. They're like, oh, here's an advocacy organization, supposedly against hate and for racial equality or whatever. So let's go work for it. Oh, we're shut out of the top echelons. How did that happen?
Yeah, exactly. That I think is the real red pill here, is that the SPLC doesn't actually do anything to improve the lives of black people. They don't.
I mean, look at the actual condition. I don't want to go down the DR3 alley, but because it's not DR3. DR3 is like a twisted way of looking at this. But the conditions of blacks have not improved.
No, the opposite.
The opposite. They've gotten there. They are living in place. They are living in. I mean, there's a kind of lawlessness, and just like failed states. I mean, look, the South Side of Chicago is a failed state, right? Yeah. Like it is.
And part of it is you know, another problem. Back to Christopher Lash is the idea that the character of a people has nothing to do with, or the intricate characteristics of a people have nothing to do with functionality, in the sense that as long as these institutions are in charge, that everything will be fine as long as you have the institutions. Well, that's been proven wrong time and time again. And on top of that, at the risk of sounding like an SJW professor, but anyway, everybody thinks I'm a communist. There are systematic elements to it that, you know, keep blacks not at their full potential.
Well, here's my thing. A lot of it's liberalism. And the thing is this, like, so a liberal attitude of how to, and this is almost like people are going to accuse of DR3, but it's really not true. Like, cause this is more of a deep red pill take on this situation. So, you know how we talk about how I'm not like the idea of Sharia law itself doesn't piss me off. It's just not appropriate for white people. Like, it's not appropriate for the West, just like mixing with a Muslim population is going to naturally create this tension, and it's not appropriate. But I am not offended by the concept of Sharia law for Muslims in their own nations. Like, that is fine for them to do. I'm not going to go crusading for women's rights in the Middle East. I don't really care.
Well, Sharia law is, again, it's an adaption to the characteristics of a people.
Exactly.
And these neocons and Zionists that say, no, we have to force democracy and Jewish neoliberalism on them with feminism and all the horrible things we have here. Those people are they're appealing to the authority of the liberal institutions, which are fucking, it's below to shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we see the same kind of thing with black people. So there's this guy, you remember Pastor Manning, Outlaw Ministries in Harlem, right? He is a guy who will be, he's an authoritarian black preacher who will slap the shit out of you if you get out of line. And he's very homophobic, and he's very against degeneracy, and in a way that is like a little bit shocking to whites because he's so blatant about it. He's so in your face. And he says like, if I see a nigga stepping, I will smack him upside the head. You know, and you see a lot of this in the black religious community, a lot of this kind of authoritarianism. And the problem is like liberalism marginalizes those types of black leaders.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of black people that need to be in charge.
Instead, like, they put AstroTurf social gospel, SJW preachers in place and quietly. Yeah.
And the SP, and then secular institutions run by Jews like the NAACP. And then you see Pastor Manning is out there. He's saying he's going hard against gay marriages. He's going hard against
Obama.
Obama and Larry Sinclair. I had a love affair. Sempa,
have you ever seen those videos of Pastor, aside from eating the poo-poo, like he actually has, Pastor Sempa has like a TV show in Uganda. And bro, watching this stuff was just surreal. Like a friend of mine showed me one of these videos. So he brought a transsexual on his show.
Oh boy.
And he's like, why are you gay? Like just, It wasn't a joke either.
The funny thing is,
see, like, no. Why are you gay? Why? No, please. Why do you dress up as a man? Are you gay? And of course, you know, this is so, you know, what was so surreal about it is that to see the power dynamic shifted, because in Uganda, if you engage in homosexual activity, you get the death penalty.
Yeah,
so he was actually poking to try and force this person to say that they engage in gay activity.
Well, the other thing is this. So
and the person that he was interviewing was like, no, I am not gay. I don't engage. I'm actually celibate. I would never engage in homosexual activity. It's so funny to see the other people on the defensive for once.
Yeah.
In America, it's the opposite. In America, if you're not gay, you're on the fucking defensive.
Yeah. And that's why, again, the idea of institutional liberalism, which that's the NAACP, is an institutional liberal organization. And it has not done right by blacks. I mean, Pastor Manning would have a somewhat functional. I mean, like, it's never going to be the same as like, you're never going to get Europe, right? Obviously. Okay.
Does it have to be?
But it doesn't have to be.
It just has to be.
But yeah, he is an example.
Else.
But he's sort of like the Sharia law for blacks and the other, and as a Christian, the black Muslims, you get Nation of Islam stuff. Nation of Islam was able to get blacks wearing suits and marching in straight lines through like heavy authoritarianism. Right? Like, that's the other thing. It's like, you can't, that is what they respond to. That is their version of quote unquote, you know, Sharia law or whatever. And we have to let these people be who they are.
We would let them be who they are.
We want them to be who they are.
And just for the record, Pastor Manning is on the SPLC's hate
yes,
list.
Yes. Of course he is. Because he's anti-homosexual.
Yeah, and they're trying to link him. They say the topic of – here's something from 2015. They're saying white supremacists and black pastors coming together. It says topic of Manning's speech will be the true state of black America. An interesting title considering Manning is African-American speaking to the – blah, 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 blah. So the SPLC, a group that is ostensibly for blacks, for the well-being of blacks, is going out there demonizing the few leaders in the black communities willing to organize the people in a productive, good way.
Yeah, and he had his own property, and he owned a bunch of property, and that's for his churches up. And then the Jews in the legal departments in New York City, they started going after him. They started going after him on taxes, on real estate deals, on everything. And look, maybe I'm not going to doubt that the guy was maybe stuffing $1,000 bill.
Everyone,
who cares? Everyone does it, and whatever. I don't care. But like, he, as a black leader, he was having black people that were responding well and were like living better lives than like the graded way that they live in places like the South Side of Chicago and these other totally failed, decrepit places. And that's what they need. And we have to understand that and respect that rather than trying to rule over them with liberal institutions, which lead to things like the South Side of Chicago. One of the problems in the South Side of Chicago is the liberal assumptions of the police department or whoever is advising the police department means they can't just go and fucking take all the people that are like leading the violence and just fucking put them away. They can't do that because of all this shit. But it's also
so notice, I mean, if you were to be a subversive, what would you do to get the maximum or the absolute worst out of the community, whether black or white or any race? You would, one, browbeat and shut down their leaders like Pastor Manning, guys that are doing the right thing. And on top of that, empower the criminal elements in the community, which is what they're doing with the prison reform shit.
Yeah.
So this is what the world that they create. And I won't even get into, Zionist controlled BET and all that, essentially articulate a side of the black community that, you know, people like Pastor Manning are fighting against. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what would you do? Well, you would do exactly that, wouldn't you? So that really is, it really blows up what the SPLC and groups like that are really about, which is not about, improving the lives of anyone, but, in fact, pushing the Zionist and Jewish agenda to create a permanent conflict between groups of people, and on top of that, to empower Jews while this is happening, and to crush their enemies.
Yeah, and Douglas Reed was able to detect this, and he even saw some documents from the American Jewish Committee where they were saying this blatantly, because, you know, you can look at some of the minutes of their meetings, and it's a roundabout way that they talk about this stuff, but you can detect it when you see it. And so he saw some of those documents, and he also just observed the situation. And, you know, he wrote another book prior to that where he was observing the situation in America. And he was saying, like, in his travels, you know, he's a British guy, he didn't really see a desire amongst either whites or blacks for the populations mixing together. Blacks wanted better conditions, but there was not this desire. And even when the school thing, the school desegregation is one of the first things that they did with Brown versus Board of Ed and all that stuff. That was not something the blacks were really big on. And there was voices in the black community that were actually against it. And that was one thing you could get in the '50s. You could have black people
into the '60s
that were coming out, and they were like, no, we don't want this. We are not interested in this.
No.
We want our own
schools. They would rather have more money for their own schools than that.
Yes, they would.
That was never on the table.
No, it was not on the table. It was like separate can't ever be equal. It's like, well, it's never going to be equal. Yeah. Together is not equal either.
Well, the argument they made in the Supreme Court was just preposterous. There was no constitutional argument for it.
High-level
people. We want to do this. Yeah. It was a total rationalization after the fact that they made the decision, rationalize it anyway. But what I will say here is
they also use it. I mean, that's the other thing. So it's an unprincipled decision that is like a pre-decided factor, and now they just reference that. Like that case is precedent that is referenced in cases going down to today. We're like, well, separate's not equal because Brown versus Board of Ed said so. So
yeah, I love that. That's why they all cheat to get into Harvard with Singer.
Yeah,
because you know all you need to get in a liberal capitalist America, all you need to have the truth is to be wearing a lab coat. Like, oh, I'm listening to this guy. He's wearing a lab coat, so he must be knowing what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Like, that's that the appeal to experts and authority. That's one of the reasons why they're so nervous right now and coming after us so hard, is that people don't believe in them anymore.
Yeah.
They don't defer to the experts or authority or the media or the journalists or anything. You know, if you read Matt Taibbi's book on the Trump presidency, it's called – Don't judge it just by its title. It was probably an editor that came up with it. It's called Insane Clown President. And in fact, actually,
it's
now
kind of funny,
a lot of Nazis might actually
these days
like
it's
that.
Like, yeah,
with the honk honk clown world people.
Yeah, just you should have used the honk honk Pepe as the cover for that.
Yeah, you should do a reprint. But in that book, he was talking about how you know the journalist class is just high on its own farts that they. For forever, ever since the Second World War, they've had this kind of authority, this totally baseless authority where they feel they have the right to choose presidents for people. So when it didn't go their way, they got really upset about that, which is why you see now, like, they spend all their time doxing people and going after people's jobs and going after people's families and writing, you know, horrible things about people and attacking dissidents. It's because they were really fucking butthurt by the fact that they had all of this stuff. They told you not to vote for Donald Trump and people did it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So they are so mad about that. And I think that, you know, what he says in Insane Clown President was that the people in the media, when they first saw Trump, they were kind of laughing about it.
Yeah.
And they're like, let's let this go for a little bit. And then we'll pull all the stops out. We'll do what we do every other presidential candidate we ruin. And he actually was going through a list of incidents in the last 20 years of politicians that journalists ruined with little bullshit fucking controversies and gossip. So they let Trump go on for a little bit, and then they're like, okay, now we got to cut this guy off. Mm-hmm. And they started throwing all this shit at him. Nothing would stick. And they started to get really angry about it. So I think this is something that really that book that Matt Taibbi wrote is really, even though I don't agree with a lot of the shit in it, it's very interesting insight into the mind of a journalist, people that live in bubbles, people that as Matt Taibbi would say, they don't even go to the store to buy their own cigarettes. When they're on the campaign trail, they get aides to do it for them. And on top of that, to be on the campaign trail, you actually need a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So the smaller journal, because you have to pay like a $10,000 fee to travel with these, you know, to send people to travel with these politicians.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's actually a fucking price of admission to cover these beats. So what he was saying is that, you know, the only people allowed to do this are people that are highly vetted by oligarchs in the corporate news media, which is why you get, again, a bit of an echo chamber with this stuff, you know?
A bit. You know, it's like, but it's also like, yeah, I mean, I think that you also would see like a theme is them talking about how horrible it is. I mean, this is the one thing I will always thank Donald Trump for, even though he's been basically a shit show, is the stuff against the media. Him just standing up there and just straight up, these people are liars. They're lying to you. And then, their reaction to that is just like insanity. They cannot deal with it. And they do. They think they have the right to be the opinion setters, the taste makers, setting the agenda setters. Mm-hmm. They think they have like some eternal right to do that. I mean, there's all this high and mighty journalists. Remember, like, they tried this Thank a Journalist Day, the most ratioed tweet. The most ratioed tweet I think I've ever seen in my life was they tried this AstroTurf Thank a Journalist, and it's just like, it was literally like everyone was like, yeah, fuck you, and like the Learn to Code thing and all of this stuff. It's just like people just hate you. And it's not even just right wingers. Like there's increasing, you know, it's just like
people hate them for the same. Imagine, you know, I think one of the reasons people, you know, one of the big reasons, you know, people hate journalists to begin with because they're, I said this before, they're busybodies. Yeah. Everyone fucking hates a busybody. But when you start to go after a 70-year-old lady that accidentally tweeted a quote Russia meme, Russia
yes,
just
exactly.
When you start to go and fuck with people like that, like take whatever preconceived notions people have about journalists and hating them and multiply that by 1,000 when
right.
You're punching
it's
down
like, yeah, it's
at
like,
working class people that have different opinions from you or maybe whatever, and you're going out there trying to ruin their lives, going after teenage boys, going after working class people, getting people fired. You just build up and incur that horrible karma, and it builds up and it builds up. So it goes from people saying, oh, journalists are gay, to grab a brick. You know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like, it's one thing if your busybodiness is being pointed at like the rich and the powerful. And like nobody really gets angry about celebrity journalism poking into the affairs and trying to get like, oh, who did a sex tape, or let me, the paparazzi getting pictures of celebrities on the beat. No one gives a shit because like the people that follow that are fucking morons anyway, but it's also just like, who cares? Like, it's just stupid entertainment crap. And then when they try to uncover, you know, there was some respect for investigative journalists who would try to uncover political scandals or corporate scandals, you know, look into what a big company was doing or like a powerful politician or something.
Yeah. That's
but,
real journalism.
But they don't do that anymore. They're going, they're pulling up like CNN vans pulling up in the driveway of some lady that like retweeted, you know, that friended a Russian bot on Facebook. And yeah. Like, CNN yeah. is there.
Or
they're on the case.
Trying to whip up a lynch mob against a teenage boy yeah. like Huffington.
Yeah, and
like,
also
one likes that shit. And now another thing that's hurting the media a lot too is that now with social media, they all have Twitter, and they all give their opinion.
Oh yeah, they tell you what they think,
and people see that, and they're like, "Whoa, you're a fucking psychopath.
These people are fucking scumbags.
You guys are fucking scumbags. Yeah, Holy shit, you believe this?
And they're
this
also
is what
like,
you believe, Sarah Jung. This is what you believe." Anyone.
Oh yeah, the Sarah Jung thing, it's like, that's another thing. And I think this all goes back to sort of part of what we see is kind of like just an increasing, I would say, you know, insanity of life in America, is because even people that hate journalists and hate the media, if you imbibe it, if you imbibe it and you believe it, like you're a crazy person. Right? Because you believe insane and stupid things. Like you see, like Trump derangement syndrome is a perfect example. So Trump derangement syndrome is largely a product of I'll say boomer liberals, a lot of them mostly women, that are probably also going through menopause at the same time, or possibly have toxoplasmosis from too many cats or whatever, whatever it might
25 be. 25 cats.
Whatever it might be, the TDS, you know, not TDS on TRS, but Trump derangement syndrome is mostly, the main
thing. Well, now with Trump affected, cucking, TDS should be renamed.
Yeah.
Trump derangement syndrome.
Yeah. But we're not deranged. We have a rational critique. The main victims of this are these cat ladies, but they're going along with the Rachel Maddows and that. So they're insane because they're listening to the media. So they believe insane things, but the people that don't believe it, that imbibe it,
right,
they go insane because they're like, there's nothing here is, what do you, there's nothing here for me. There's no rational truth. There's nothing in this conversation. I'm not included in it. But not only am I not included in it, it's insane. There's no truth or even, you know, defensible point. Like, you have this phony dialectic of two, just like two points of view that are just totally at odds with reality. And it's enough to drive you crazy. And I think that's partly why you see some of the responses to the response of, say, we were always talking about, like, the Boomer Waffen and the response to their response to the New Zealand shooting. This is because they are driven half mad with
the Daily Caller comments.
The total lack of any perspective that takes their side or any advocacy or rational point on behalf of white people. I mean, it's in a distorted form, they're expressing.
Everyone knows my view on the mosque shooting. Sure. I don't like it. I'm against it. What I will say is, though, that what makes people mad is, you know, when you have a situation like that, it's all over the news. Whites are collectively blamed for it. But then when you have a shooting literally the next day, it's just business as usual. It's just, oh, well, that's just part and parcel, right? That's what a lot of people were quoting. So that's what makes people really, really angry and makes them snap. You know, when you see that kind of gaslighting, right?
And the callous indifference to the suffering of whites. And it's not just in terms of Muslim terror attacks, in terms of immigration generally, the
importation. Economics too.
The economic situation. And then when you have, people that start to express the vaguest amount of concern for the suffering of whites, they are brought into check by others. So you would see that some people would start to talk about, well, part of have you gone and looked in middle America and seen the deindustrialization and the suffering and the drug crisis, the suicide crisis? Have you seen this? And the counties that are suffering this also voted heavily for Trump. People pointing this out, they would start getting attacked by others, people in their profession, saying, no, that's why there's all these people are racist, because of economic insecurity. Like, you know, they would do like a sarcastic thing, like an in before you start talking about insecure white people. But then it's also treated like, well, one, white people deserve to be insecure. It's just their fragility that they're reacting poorly to it.
That's the private view, and increasingly the public view.
And it's like, this is why white people get angry and lash out, because you have this absolute callous and almost, you know, misanthropic indifference to their suffering, and there's no outlet allowed. So if you do that, you have to expect something like that New Zealand shooting, and you have to expect that there's going to be people out there that are going to be like, yes, I support, I am.
Well, maybe they do. Maybe they do expect it, and they use it as an excuse to crack down on civil liberties.
I mean, which that's definitely the
dialectic that Michael Tracy was talking about. He was talking about the dialectic that, you know, when there's an Islamic shooting, they crack down on civil liberties. It's supported by conservatives. And then when there's a, quote, right-wing extremist shooting, then the left is the one calling for civil liberties. So you have, the kosher sandwich. Ultimately, all of us are worse off for it. It stifles the debate, and it makes the problem worse.
And white people are, in both of those cases, the thing is, on at least when there are people that out there advocating for Muslims and saying, like, think about their communities and what they're feeling after this attack, because they're going to feel scared because their white people are going to be all mad at them, right? Mm-hmm. There's no similar rhetoric from the right when,
nope.
You know, the right starts talking like fucking liberals when this happens. Like they go into full disavowal mode. They go into full, which I understand disavowing, but it's like, it's more than that. It's like, cause the Muslims will also disavow terrorist attacks, but it's like, there is this, it's just white people can never be defended. We can never have a human case. Yeah. And when you treat people like that,
or advocacy,
when you treat people like that, when that's the dialectic and that's the narrative as it is, when white people simply cannot have a human case, you're going to get some white people are going to do some pretty fucking inhuman things.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
And other factors going on, you know, this is kind of what Tucker was talking about, you know, how about pill epidemics, unemployment,
broken
families.
I mean, I think that this country,
alienation.
The United States is a fucking basket case, and dude, it's not just us.
It's really we're going into uncharted waters.
Yeah, it's a very very place that we're headed towards. I think
this is something other people have pointed out. There's no historic precedent for what is going on in the West today.
Yeah.
So where we're going to end up, where we're going to is. Well, you should be very concerned because it's going to be something so crazy that's never been seen in human history. If we don't put the stops on this and steer the ship towards a more constructive.
Yeah, I have to reiterate that I think that my approach, and maybe I'll have turned out to be wrong, I don't know, but my approach is to simply try to tell the truth and be as rational and truthful, which is not to say like cold and distant or not feeling, but try to put out the truth as best as I see it. I don't have another answer. I mean, we understand that the answer to ethnic strife is separation, is actually separating groups that are going to fight. Why would you put, why would you put like a lion and a gorilla in a cage in a zoo together?
Unless you're Joe.
Unless you want to see like a animal gladiator fights. You know what I mean? Right. Like that's the only reason you would do it. I mean, the fucking Romans would do this with ethnic groups. They'd be like, oh, let's watch the Thracian and the Syrian fight. You know, like they would do that. Remember? You watch Spartacus?
They're honest about it. I mean, that's
they were just honest about it. They're like, yeah, we've got
that's what I loved about the old school totalitarians.
Yeah.
There's a kind of refreshing, you know, really what I hate is the sheer gaslighting of the liberal system where they do something and then pretend it's not what you're seeing.
Yeah.
That is what makes me angry more than anything.
That's what makes people insane, dude.
I mean, think of stuff like, you know, the new program in the Trump budget to export feminism around the world. Like, you know, did you vote for that?
Who that voted for Trump wants that?
Did my grandma vote for that? Did anyone in your family or friends or social circle come up with that idea as a major issue?
Why? So, well,
why not just come out and say, listen, we are exporting feminism because we want to make America's enemies just as weak as Americans are and incapable of fighting the government as Americans are. We want to weaken them so that we can fight and invade them and control them too. Why not just come out and say it?
But that's it's also like, given who voted for Trump and their attitude towards feminism,
or Trump himself,
and Trump himself and his attitude. And then it's like, why would he do this? Why would he do something that literally none of his voters support? Not a one, down to the man, the Trump.
That no one came up with, like, no normal people came up with that idea.
Yeah.
Even like milquetoast, like average liberals never thought up of an idea of exporting feminism using taxpayer money as our country falls apart. I mean, as potholes get bigger, as bridges collapse, as fucking airports dwindle, airports crumble. Who really came up with the idea? No. Let's take money from the budget that Donald Trump is now talking about. He wants to cut the budget domestically. In other words, cut people's Social Security and shit. Let's take that money and use it to support Pussy Riot in Russia.
Right.
Who came up with that?
Whose idea? $100 million. You know, you could give 10,000 people $1,000.
Yeah.
With that. Right. Yeah. Why don't you do that? I mean, that would be a better, that's the funny thing about Yang is actually saying like, well, the government's doing a lot of pointless stuff. They could just give everybody money. Why not do that? And look, one of the hopes I had for Trump, which was like, I was like, you know, the immigration issue is kind of fraught. Maybe we'll get something there. Maybe we won't. But I actually, silly me, and I was wrong. I genuinely thought Trump was going to do like a multi-billion dollar, perhaps trillion dollar internal infrastructure project. That was going to just, he said he, like, we're going to do highways, bridges, tunnels.
That could have united the country. It would have been, creates jobs.
It would have been a huge boon to the country.
That creates, I'll tell you what, that creates, jobs in a way, creates middle class jobs in a way that, the tax cuts for the rich don't.
No, they don't. That's economic. Fallacious economic thinking to think that, look, yep. I mean, look, the people always, a lot of the Jewish economic, thinking is just a way to get you to not do anything that's going to help you. Like, it really has become apparent that, like, oh no, we can't. And the part of the reason the infrastructure in America is crumbling is because the Republican Party adopted this free market ideology and then fights against it. Like, the Republicans always fight against this stuff. Democrats for a while actually had a history because they had a working class base of support of wanting to fund this stuff. And, you know, who was the guy that built the highway? It was freaking Eisenhower. He was a Republican. So it wasn't that they were always against this.
Who also taxed capital gains at like 90%. Insane.
Well, in the highest bracket, but yeah, like
fine, but no one's doing that here. The highest bracket don't pay any taxes.
Yeah, I mean, which is that's ridiculous. So and think about $1 trillion. Think about Trump's like we're gonna put over 4 years, maybe even, I mean, I think we do it 1 year. But over 4 years, we will put $1 trillion into rebuilding the inside of our country, the jobs that would be created, the hope that would be created. You know what I mean? The actual, like, patriotic and nationalistic, feeling that would be created. People would be happy.
The hope.
People would feel like there was something happening. Like, things were going, you'd go around the country and you'd see things being built and being renovated and you would feel like things were getting better. People were getting pulled out of unemployment into jobs. And, you know, the tariff stuff, that's good too. You want to bring back some private industry and private production, but we could have also done the other. So I was hopeful that he was going to do that because I was sort of like, finally, because the Democrats will support that. Right.
Yep.
Oh, but no, not
that
now.
That would unite the country. In fact,
but not
in
now.
Ways even across the various competing interests, it would, that one thing, if your interest is actually to unite the country, that would do it.
Well, that's the thing is, like, I think the thing with Trump was that people still see, and there still could have been done in 2016, and still could even be done now. You could fix this. If you had somebody, and people were like, this guy has the will to do it, and he's broken through the necessary barriers, is like this Hail Mary pass to get this guy into the office so we could break through all this bullshit. But as it turned out, you know, whether he wanted to and got cowed or was always a shill, I can't tell you. But he effectively, I think at this point, has been totally cowed, so it doesn't matter.
Let's see what he does after the Mueller report is finished.
That'll be kind of a final test, but
it'll be a final test. If he starts back up to how he was before, then, you know, maybe it might
be. You have to still be wary.
I consider getting back on the Trump show. I'm like a fucking ex-wife.
Yeah, you're like a beaten.
Getting a booty call at 2 a.m. I had a few drinks.
Well, the other thing is this, though.
He's very charismatic and funny.
We have to.
I'm just joking, obviously. I think right now Trump has been pretty useless overall.
Yeah, but, well, if I was even to entertain what you're talking about, I was actually surprised to hear you say that. But it would have to be, there'd have to be action. It can't just be tweets. It can't just be like, oh, Mueller probe is over, Trump's back to base tweeting. Because he's been doing base tweeting the whole time.
Exactly.
But eventually people got tired of it. I mean, people loved the tweets at first, but it's like, I don't care. Now they just piss me off.
Well, now his tweets are all about, oh, they're talking about Israel.
Well, he's doing that. His tweets are about two things. Mueller probe is a setup.
And Stop making fun of me on SNL.
Yeah, it's just stupid shit. It's like, it's like whatever. There's nothing to it. You know, he did tweet in defense of Tucker. I wonder if I like
2012 Trump tweets, like the one about Arianna Huffington, where he's like, she looks like a dog. I'm not surprised her husband turned gay.
Yeah. No, I mean, that was the funny stuff. I mean, that was why the journalists couldn't fucking believe this guy was elected. But like, but you know, it's like, yeah, like it's, if anything was to ever happen, I mean, look, I just don't think it's going to, because what is he going to do? He's got to actually do something. He's got to actually get something done.
I mean, remember he made a big thing at CPAC about an executive order to protect the First Amendment on college campuses. Where is it? Where the fuck is it? I don't remember.
Yeah, I mean,
how it is. That's his response to everything.
He floated.
He's always talking big game. He's like, I'm currently working on an executive order to protect free speech on social media. Where is it?
Well, he didn't even say social media. He said campus, college campus. And the funny thing is, and I was a little bit puzzled because he was talking about how he wanted to do. Now, the innovation would be if a state funded campus denied access to a speaker, they would lose their state funding. That's the executive order he wants
exactly.
to do. That's going to be met with lawsuit after lawsuit. But the other thing is, as we saw during the Richard Spencer College tour, Richard was able to successfully sue these colleges and force them to host him. Cause he was always canceled. They always would cancel. And that's unconstitutional. Heckler's veto is unconstitutional. So there's kind of already a protection there. But the thing is, it does seem that I would not be surprised today if Richard tried to book a speaking engagement on a campus and they just said no. And then he sued and then the decision went the opposite way because Antifa managed to stir up enough chaos and violence that like literally they actually engaged Heckler's veto.
It's the reaction after Charlottesville.
Yes.
They don't want. And the thing that scared them about Charlottesville wasn't even the violence or anything. It was actually the sheer numbers.
It was the numbers of people that were there.
So that's why it might go the other way, or they have other tricks, or finding a lawyer to do the lawsuit is going to become more difficult. They have many little tricks. Well,
the final trick is Antifa. I remember the Michigan State, there was a lawsuit there. Eventually they backed out of it because they saw that he had won every other one. So they backed out of it and like, all right, we'll give you the speaking, but what we're going to do is we're just going to have the cops kind of sit back on their heels and let the Antifa run wild. And then your whole thing is going to be a shit show. You'll get blamed, and we can count on the media blaming you for it.
I didn't watch it, but even Nick Fuentes, like he went to a state school in Iowa.
And that was private.
It wasn't. It was the state university.
No, but it was a private. It was a private event. It wasn't.
Oh,
like,
right. It was unannounced. Yeah.
Yeah. It was the Republican Club invited him. They had booked a room, as they are allowed to do, being the Republican Club on campus. They're allowed to book a room where they were going to go listen to him speak. Somehow it got out, and a shit show ensued.
Yeah, the Black Student Alliance came and essentially did the heckler's veto there. I mean, there's not going to be Antifa in Iowa. That's something that really exists largely in bougie hipster areas. But still, you can still have people you can activate. And the local NAACP was apparently responsible for activating this mob. And they essentially were able to heckle Nick Fuentes. And Nick Fuentes is not that extreme. He's just a paler conservative.
Well, I guarantee you Nick Fuentes is not going to go there and start talking about attacking black people.
No.
That was he wanted to talk about immigration. He basically wanted to talk about immigration.
Have a discussion. Yeah.
Yeah. And he even actually after the fact, there's video of him talking about immigration with these blacks and saying you don't get it. Like, no.
Yeah.
And it was just like, he was kind of just like barking up the wrong tree, but it was like, he wasn't going to go there and give some anti-black racist. It's absurd. When you think about it, it's actually absurd. The picture that they paint, similarly, like Richard Spencer doesn't do that either. Like nobody does that.
But it's funny. Even if they were, you still don't have a right to silence someone on a state campus. You don't have a right to do that. And the fact that the police look on and let them do it, and then if you respond in kind, they arrest you. That is the new strategy.
That's basically what they've done. And
I mean, yeah. I saw some other stuff where they actually, I don't want to make people paranoid, but the police doxed someone putting up flyers through their fingerprints. So even if we were all to wipe our asses with the First Amendment, even if, and prosecute putting up political flyers, the only real crime or violation you can maybe rationalize out of that is a littering fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Littering. So can you imagine if someone were to toss a piece of paper on the ground or an empty water bottle somewhere, the police putting up a yellow tape all around it and chalking the water bottle and then dusting for prints on it? No, this is clearly political. This is to intimidate political to chill political speech by telling you, hey, if you put up any flyers, First Amendment protected flyers, we, the police, at the insistence of the Anti-Defamation League, will start cataloging people. So that is the message these pigs are trying to send. And you know, if we had, that's why, again, we have to keep building the legal networks, because this kind of stuff, if you were to gather the money and the resources and the manpower to take these assholes, these pigs to court, not only would you win, you would even be able to possibly get a nice big fat settlement out of it. So, you know, this is the gaping the lack that we have right now. This is what we need to focus on.
There's also a potential, I mean, in terms of that flyering case, which I was looking into, there is a potential argument here, which is like, one, yes, the ultimately it's going to be a misdemeanor charge. It's not even going to be jail. It's
not even a no, it's not a misdemeanor. It's a violation.
Yeah. It's going to be a ticket. It's going to be, so they did a 6 months investigation. They used fingerprinting. They brought detectives in. I mean, time was, I remember when people were talking about flyering campaigns, like 3 years ago, putting up flyers on, you know, on lampposts and, you know,
You can tell the people behind the project to catalog people putting up flyers are probably boomers at the ADL or people with very low strategic thinking.
Well, I mean,
it's not, the flyers are not even 1% of the recruitment.
they want, but the media campaign around it is part of the chilling factor. So it's like, we used to say, like, if people were doing that, you know, it would be like, do you really think they're going to, you know, because it used to be that people would see them and they would, like, you know, Jews would see like a white nationalist leaning flyer and they would call the police, and police would like take down the flyer and be like, oh, we're looking into it. And then they just let it go because they don't care.
Mm-hmm.
But now
it's not a crime.
That was how it was. That was how it was like 3 years ago. Now they actually marshal all the resources. Because they find the violation and then they marshal all of it. So I'm wondering, like, to the people in that county or that town, do you really like the fact that the cops in your town, that's where, cause unlike the taxes to the federal government, towns can't just generate money. So their budget is just coming out of the money that you pay in taxes. So all these cops that you're paying, like, that is a direct revenue, like, tax to revenue relationship at the local level.
Yeah.
It's not at the federal government. They just print the money. Localities, municipalities can't. So they have to pay their police directly out of the budget that they get from taxing the people. So your property taxes went to a 6 months investigation, fingerprint lab, you know, and what? So a kid could pay a $200 fine?
Yeah, so if someone, like, I don't even think they find him. They just doxed him.
Yeah, well, that's the real issue, is that they want him doxed.
And I'll tell you what, you know, go ahead. Even if you live in a small town, someone steals your fucking lawnmower, or you know, there's a bar fight or something, and someone calls the cops, and you report it. Are they going to spend 6 months and enormous amounts of resources investigating that? No, they usually, if they don't catch the person in the act, they just don't investigate it. Usually the excuse is that their resources are taken up by more important things. And apparently one of those more important things is finding a college student putting up a First Amendment protected flyer with some fucking Greek statue or something, or the new stuff, which is like the Susan Sarandon giving you a hug. I kid, Mark.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, I kid, Mark. Yeah, but it's also like, it's like, think about the other stuff the federal government's doing in terms of the RAM case. I mean, these were, I mean, we've all seen some of the videos, like the Huntington Beach. Yeah. It was a scuffle. Nobody was even hurt.
It was a scuffle, by the way. The people that belong there were the people that the FBI is arresting.
Yes.
The people that were invited, parts of the permitted rally, Donald Trump supporters were invited and part of the political rally and demonstration. The people that don't belong there are the ones that show up with hammer claws and fucking ski masks, yes, and start assaulting people. And so those are the ones that don't belong
there. They came. Now, who conspired to riot at Huntington Beach? They came with a hammer and crowbar, which I have the video of the police confiscating that from some of the Antifa that I arrested. They were masked and they started running up and macing people. Pepper spraying. Just pepper spraying an old lady. Pepper spraying an old lady to try to take her bag. And of course, the guy that did that, look, again, you know, in a sane world, there was a guy, and it wasn't even a member of RAM. This was just some boomer Trump supporter. Clocked this guy. Like, you know, he's like, really? You maced an old lady and tried to grab her bag? Well, boom.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so exactly. Like, you know, that's what happens.
You're coming in with a claw hammer and assaulting people with your weapons.
And apparently,
expect nothing, no one to retaliate. Yeah. I mean, what fucking world are these glow-in-the-dark niggers working
with? And that's the other thing, is that the inability to just kind of say that outright, like, that's a real chilling on speech, because it's like that, like, everyone can see that video. It's on video and everyone can see it, and they see what happens and see what's going on. And it's literally like, well, that's what happens, Larry. You go in and you assault an old woman. Well, guess what? The angry boomer standing next to her is going to clock you.
Yeah.
And like,
exactly.
And like, that's just what happens. And if you expect another outcome is insane, and it's not even illegal. You know, it's actually considered totally legal to defend another person from an attack.
And even if it can be spun in a way where it is illegal, most cops will be like, eh.
Well, they didn't care. That's the thing.
They didn't care. The actual local cops, to their credit,
they did not give a shit.
I've actually gotten messages from people that tell me, like, listen, man, not all cops are bad. Because, you know, I am a bit of an ACAB type. Blame my Wignat and Bonafides. But, what I will say is that the local cops, whatever their flaws may be, cops on a local level, even in California, did not arrest these guys.
Because they didn't care.
The actual criminals. The people that went for the political stuff were the feds.
Yeah.
It's the feds that do the political stuff.
Yeah. Okay? And that's the thing, that the federal government came in 2 years later in the actual time. Now, there's also like, there's probably a certain unawareness of some of these cops to the background political struggle that was actually going on. Because and I've seen this before. They don't understand the Antifa thing. They're like, what the hell is this? Like, they don't even get it. So they just see these masked people come and attacking people, waving American flags. They're like, what the fuck? So,
right.
So, and of course, if they see somebody in that crowd, a working class guy in that crowd, fight back, they don't care. And then it's, so it has to be like 2 years later that you get, you know, Thomas Cullen or other federal attorneys trying to frame these people up on some kind of bullshit rioting charge.
Yeah.
And it's total garbage. And yeah, that to the credit of the police in Huntington Beach. And of course the Antifa are out there yelling, cops helping fascists again. It's like, no.
Yeah.
Cops are literally just arresting fucking people dressed like ninjas attacking old boomers.
The terrifying thing about that, though, is, again, like we always say, like, you can laugh at these people screaming, the cops and the Klan go hand in hand. But that narrative is now, it's being institutionalized in our federal government.
Yeah.
So that narrative now there's a pressure from the federal government on local police precincts to start punishing people for their political views.
Yes, exactly.
And that's not a good thing, because then you get into a situation that we have now. The real way that they're chilling speech is they give you two choices if you go out and demonstrate. One, and this includes demonstrating not just for fascists or national socialists or racial whatever, but even if you go out and demonstrate for the American flag or Donald Trump, they give you two choices. One, the first choice, let these noodle-armed anarchists beat you and mace little old ladies and beat you with their batons and kill you. Or two, fight back and get arrested by the cops.
And potentially get charged with conspiracy for planning to rally at all.
And then have a problem with the FBI and then lose your job and then this and that and this and that. So those are the two choices they give you, which is the real reason. Listen, all you motherfucking Antifas out there that pirate this show and put it out and listen for intelligence. You Antifas didn't do anything. Okay. Yeah. The only reason you have some control over the street is because one, you're irrelevant, and two, because the FBI and the media and the rich are supporting you.
Yeah, they're in
your
corner.
And it's not even – they're using you. And you know what? Here's the funny thing. Once they see you're no longer needed, they're going to come after you too, because some of these Antifa, they still have Trump derangement syndrome.
Yeah.
But it's not going anywhere because the oligarchs have made their peace with Trump. But the Antifa, as fanatics, they're still – like they were going out protesting Donald Trump's invisible emergency wall.
Yeah.
Like the invisible wall he claims is in. So the Antifa actually went out to protest this across the nation. And lo and behold, no one showed up.
That's because
the elites and the media are not interested in that anymore. They are they understand that Trump is not going to build any wall, and it's that simple. So but the problem is you still have this core of Weather Underground style fanatics that still want to keep going. So let's think of a situation where they start to become, as all irregular armies, they start to become a bit of a liability for the system.
Because, well, I mean, look, if Trump makes his peace with Zionism and mass immigration, which he seems to have done, I mean, he was always at peace with Zionism, although he went against their wishes with Syria. It looks like now we're leaving 1,000 troops in Syria, not just 400.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's a rumor. I could be false. I saw that. It could be the media trying to meme it, but increasingly.
Why would they?
So. Now that that has happened, the people that are still these continuing anti-Trump fanatical
Hold on. I looked it up just now. Yep. The military is going to leave 1,000 troops in Syria now.
Yeah.
So we go from withdrawal to 400 to 1,000.
this will be the final point is that, for those of you that still like ultimately – they might just want him to be president again. And then when you go out and you attack and those that are still supporting him, he's going to lose. He's losing a lot. He's bleeding support. At least there's no enthusiasm. So if people vote for him again in 2020, it will be with resignation rather than enthusiasm. So
it'll be entirely because of the Democrats.
Yeah, which, it'll be because they're afraid of how anti-white the other candidate is.
Not even. The Democrats have their own enthusiasm problem. I don't care what anyone says that the Democrats are pumped up. I don't see anyone pumped up for Beto O'Rourke or Kamala Harris. Well,
other than single women in their 40s.
Well, no, not even. The only people I see pumped up for Beto O'Rourke are people in the media who, back to Matt Taibbi, you know, these people think that they can still pick presidents for people.
Yeah.
Wait until they realize that no one is actually even Democratic voters aren't falling for Beto O'Rourke, the skateboarder who's gonna, you know, because the man has no policy proposal. Like Yang has, say what you want about Yang. Perhaps his UBI pitch is, let's say, seeing the world through very narrow eyes. perhaps he's a one issue narrow.
That's a very funny. Look, this guy has a. You've got a very narrow view on things. It's, it takes kind of a slanted view on policy, if you will.
So perhaps you can laugh about that, but you know, free money gets people pumped up.
At least it's something.
One thing the Democrats and the political consulting class is going to really pay for, and that includes Trump and the GOP consultants, is the appetite for authenticity in our modern age. People want something authentic. And when you are insincere, like the GOP consultants and like the Beto O'Rourke campaign, which is a fucking joke. I mean, no one thinks this man is sincere. He's got no policy.
He got that right up. You got that right up in Vanity Fair over the weekend, and that picture on the cover of Vanity Fair, taken by Annie Leibovitz. Oh my God.
Oh, famous, and it was, famous for the LeBron James and Heidi Klum gorilla photoshoot.
Oh,
famous
geez.
For the weird fetal position John Lennon picture. Famous for the
famous
child
for,
pornography of Brooke Shields.
Yeah, famous for just jewing up photography in general. Yeah, so she takes that. That's a callback to a Ronald Reagan picture from the 80s. Like, it's literally, there's a picture of Ronald Reagan on a dirt road standing outside a pickup in the same blue shirt and jeans, just like Beto. And it's like self-consciously so. And it's like, I don't even know what they're going for there, but it's like, it's the fakest shit I've ever seen in my life.
Dude, that dude ain't a cowboy. Just because he's from Texas doesn't mean he's a fucking cowboy.
No, he's not. He's
and
not.
Just because he's from Texas doesn't mean he's Mexican either.
Yeah, he's neither. He's like the fake. He's a middle class liberal. He's literally just like he's just like a shitlib.
He's literally like a privilege. And that's something funny that Tucker was trolling the Jew that drafted him to the election. There's some Jew. Oh, by the way, one thing, let me correct. Annie Leibovitz did not do the Brooke Shields child pornography. She actually did and said the famous Caitlyn Jenner. Just a correction there. Okay. But yeah, so the thing with Beto is that ooh, what was I saying? Jeez.
You're talking about this, Tucker was making fun of the Jew.
Right. Tucker was with the Jew that drafted, that's like behind the fake. Of course, you know, he planned to run for president as soon as he met all those donors during the Ted Cruz election.
Yeah.
But he was pretending he wasn't to, and this Jew started this draft Beto movement.
All fucking AstroTurf.
It's all AstroTurf. But anyway, this guy went on Tucker's show, and Tucker's like, you know, there's all kinds of women and women of color, and there's a gay man and people of color all over the place running for president. Why are you siding with this privileged white guy? And the guy was like, actually, Beto is very, so Tucker's like, oh, so you want the people of color and the women to run for president, but you don't want them to be president. I see. And that guy was like, oh, yeah,
that's just, it's such that, a that's point. Like on some level, like an almost like it's a very good troll. I'll just leave it.
And it's working.
I mean, it's working.
Beto has spent all his time rationalizing his skin color.
I mean, look, this is the kind of thing. It's sort of like, it's hilarious. And I think that's great that Tucker glommed onto that and did that, because it's like, why the fuck not? Like, throw these people's bullshit back in their face. You know, it's like, do it. And it's kind of like also
their own cross.
It's also like a little bit of almost a played out talking point, but I don't care. Talking points that are played out are just that, because they're around for a while for a reason, because they stay true. So.
Right.
We got to, even if
cliches,
it feels,
are cliches for a reason.
Yeah, you don't want to fall prey to the novelty seeking to stop hitting them with the same stuff over and over again.
Right.
This is why I basically repeat myself every show.
Well, I'm kind of a bit of a novelty seeker.
No, I am too. We do several shows a week, so I gotta have numerous stuff. But
it's also not novelty seeking. We're just not repeating conservative lines. We repeat our own lines. But the thing with Beto O'Rourke is it's so fake. It's such a top down imposition. Ditto for Kamala Harris, who's like the whitest black woman ever in history, and she's like, yeah, I was rolling back in the 80s. I was rolling on dubs and rocking Prada while listening to Tupac and Biggie.
Yeah, dude, blacks.
And then it came out that, like, even I knew that Tupac and Biggie weren't around when she was.
I know. That was, and the blacks were just like, everyone was just like laughing.
They were laughing. They're doing the face emojis.
As FTN calls her, Kabbalah Harris.
Oh man, no, but you know,
she has more of an authentic connection there than she does to blacks. I'll tell you.
And then you have the fag, butt gig.
Literally, his name is
butt gig.
Dude, and he's a Hufflepuff.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that.
It's,
I mean,
like,
what do you
dude,
think? Like,
what the hell is going, dude?
Not to mention, Hufflepuff is actually the gayest of the. That's probably why they, like, Hufflepuff was full of the beta males.
Dude, imagine like a world where, like, people are looking at these Democratic candidates and they're signing them like a, one of the houses from like Harry Potter. Like that's going to happen. There's going to be articles. There's going to be clickbait articles about the assigning a different Harry Potter house to every Democratic candidate.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, what's funny, Elizabeth Warren, if she could restrict some of the anti-white stuff, could actually gain traction and become a serious candidate.
Dude, no,
but she's not.
I'm going to have to disagree.
Yeah, No. She's not doing that. She's actually clinging to the anti-white stuff and being talking about reparations, I think, if I recall correctly.
Dude.
It's that.
She did
it.
It says
Elizabeth Warren is fighting for slavery reparations. Hey, good luck with that. You're going to tax working class people more. Great.
It's not going to go anywhere. She did a town hall yesterday. It was promoted by CNN. Of course, totally staged. The whole thing is staged. There's no genuine question is going to get through that.
It's like Putin on RT.
Yeah, exactly. But that's where she did say the thing about, cause the tweets were going out on her Twitter timeline as she was saying things at the time at the town hall. So someone was tweeting what she was saying. So she's saying, that's what she's saying. She's going to go, her Justice Department will go after white nationalists with full prosecution. I'm like, oh, so you're no change in policy then from Donald Trump. But, yeah. I saw some of the video of it on her Twitter timeline.
Mm-hmm.
It is so cringe watching that woman talk.
Oh, bro. Yeah.
It is like,
I mean, she could really emphasize her, you know, she did give like a speech against bankers and she did write that book a long time ago about women in the workplace and how it's just a scam. She could actually get really far if she took those things up.
Yeah, but dude, she's so
not
cringe.
Going to.
She's so not- cringe. Watching just like on just on the pure aesthetic level, I was watching these videos and I was like, how can anybody watch this woman speak and not just cringe? My whole reaction to her, it didn't matter what she was saying. She could have been quoting Hitler. Like, yeah. That would actually have been more cringe. Like, she could have been saying things I agreed with, and I would have been, like, covering my face, like, oh, my God. Because it's so bad. Just, like, her, everything about it, it's so terrible. She's like, I don't know. There's something about...
Or how about Cory Booker and his new actress pretending to be his girlfriend?
He had to get a beard.
Rosario Dawson.
Yeah, no, it's a shit show.
He had to get
show.
A girlfriend for the primaries.
Yeah, no, it's a total shit show out there.
I totally got a boo.
That's why I think like Yang, it's like he's gonna start drawing more and more attention because he's the only one of these people that talks like
Bro, have you seen his website? He has policy positions. He has like policy papers for like the most minute things.
Yeah.
Like, you know exactly what this guy believes, and he's entirely talking about policy all the time. He actually came out against circumcision the other day, which honestly, you know, that alone is actually
somebody Yang must not have talked to him.
Listen, I'm not in the Yang gang, but I will give the Yang gang this, that he is starting debates.
Yeah, and this is what I wanted to say.
That's what politics are supposed to be. It's not supposed to be about, me on a skateboard or which house in Harry Potter I'm in. It's supposed to be about, what are we going to do about automation? What do you do about college athletes or tuition debt, school tuition debt? Yeah. Or what do we do about these things? And Yang and all of his Chinese autism has like these policy papers for all of this.
Well, this is what I was saying, and I want to say this here, and then we'll go because my free speech is actually chilled on TDS because as Jesse, it only lets me talk about the $1,000 because he's like, no, it's just $1,000, and I'm like, but I want to talk about
your eyes on the money.
I want to talk about the candidate. And he's like, no, $1,000. So he's chilling my free speech, so I can talk about it here. Which is that the one thing I'll say for Yang is whether you agree with him or disagree with him. He's talking about things that are real. The threat of automation, the loss of jobs. He talked about the white death. He talked about the declining birth rate. He fucking predicted the New Zealand shooting by a few hours. Like, he gave that speech saying white people. I swear that he did.
Bro, he's got magical meme power.
Well, this is why people are starting to think it was tough. People were like almost not really wanting to say that because it was spooky. But, I remember seeing him say, like, look, white people are getting more and more disenfranchised, and there's no one representing them, and they're extremely frustrated as they dwindle in their once majority status and their privileges, and which is sort of somewhat of a leftist narrative. But he said, like, you know, at some point they might start flying off the handle and shooting up. He even said shooting up churches. He said,
yeah,
but
yeah, you know, exactly. It's not with him. It's not personal. It's simply he's an observer, and he's just telling you what's going on. And you know what I find,
he almost could only do that because he's an outsider. He is Chinese. He is you know, as I said, he's got a slanted view of things. He's coming at it from a very narrow angle.
Very narrow. Say it, they're very narrow eyes.
Yeah, exactly. It's like when examining the political scene, if you squint very hard, sometimes you can see clearly some of these hidden issues. But yeah, anyway, I don't know. But no, it's a serious issue. Like, these are real issues. No other Democrat is going to talk about the potential loss of jobs from automation. They're not going to. Because Jeff Bezos, who's automating his entire operation, is their number one donor.
Yeah. Well, not number one, but he's up there.
You know what I'm saying. He's
funding all this bullshit. I mean, we saw Beto O'Rourke got $6 million literally 48 right. hours after announcing his fucking – he's already outraised all the Democrats that have been campaigning for months now. And that tells you something, doesn't it? And it's going to be so glorious when Beto is going to be the Jeb Bush of the Democratic primaries. He's not going to catch. And if they do some magic in the primaries to steal the election for Beto, they're going to get 2016 all over again. It's that simple.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. It's going to be interesting. I actually am betting that, depending on how far things are, when things start to happen, once Yang is on stage, cause Yang is now raised enough, he's gotten himself into the playing, he's on the plane, he's there, he's going to be on the debate stage, he's done the necessary things. Are they just going to hit him with, why do all these white supremacists support you, Mr. Yang? Instead of asking him real questions.
Or they might, well, that like, you know, if you're just a regular person who's not on the internet all day, like, you know, a question like that isn't even going to make any fucking sense to you.
Yeah.
So like, it's not going to help in blocking Yang from advancing.
No.
What I think they'll do instead is, simply not ask him any questions.
Yeah.
Like, that's they're just the most not going to. They're just going to pretend like people do Asian people all the time, that they're not there. I'm serious. Like,
and he'll just quietly stand in the corner.
You know, Asian people in America, not for nothing, you know, it's not just whites that don't have advocates. Asian people in America are like 10% of the population, almost the same amount as blacks. And yet no one really addresses the Asian community by name.
Well, they don't. Well, the other thing is Asians
keep to themselves.
They keep to themselves, but they do well. They don't really. I mean, they're as a community, they're doing well.
No, but they have their own issues and intricacies. I mean, for example, the Republican Party is trying to do that now, where they're trying to peel them. Like, say, you know, Asian people get discriminated in Ivy Leagues by affirmative action that targets them as well. So they have the issues like that going on in their communities, but you don't really see anyone talking about them, or even you don't even see Asian people in movies, or, you know, oh, we need more Asian actors, or you don't really see much of that.
There's some of that around the fringes, and occasionally they will recruit like a really obnoxious young Asian woman into SJWism.
It's always women, yeah.
Then you get like a Sarah Jeong type. And it's disingenuous because, like, Asians don't suffer. I mean, look, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to part ways with you on this. Like, Asians are not suffering in the United States. They're doing
I didn't say that, but, you know, neither – well
– I mean, they might have their own issues, but they're doing
– they have their own issues.
They're doing very well here. And that's why they're not really – you know, their lack of advocates, it's like – you know, and I, frankly, like, the issue – I'm not going to go to bat for them with the affirmative action thing because – I don't like them squeezing whites out of universities in white countries.
Right. Me neither. Yeah.
So like,
no, I agree
with
that.
That's a big problem. I mean, look, it's a troll against the Jews, but we gotta be careful with it because it's like, I don't want to.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't saying what I was saying though is that, that is a big issue in their community. And you don't see the coalition of the Ascendant really even talking to, you don't see them like campaigning to Asians or anything. That was my only point. And you know what's funny is that if they did, they could probably get a lot of money because Asian people, like you said, they have money.
They got money.
And they could probably get a lot of donations, but they just don't, like, people don't even see them. You know, so one of my friends that lives in Spain actually was telling me, and, you know, Spain, believe it or not, has a lot of Asian people in it. And if you go to Barcelona, they own all the shops. And he was telling me, like, this is kind of, it's nothing personal, of course, but this is kind of like a silent invasion. You don't really hear it or sense it.
Yeah. You know, well, they absolutely network ethnically. There is no question.
Yeah.
They are totally, they have their internal ethnic networks. And in a way, see, like, in a way, white people could possibly learn from this in some ways. It's that, like, they took this landscape of America as this rootless society with no grounding and no sense of itself and purely based on like, you know, platitudes about freedom, liberty, and, you know, then this market capitalism thing. And they just came and they're not trying to control the culture like the way Jews do, but they just totally internally have ethnic nepotism with business ties and money and things
like that. Which is perfectly... Listen, they're the normal ones. Like, I don't like
people
about...
People say, like, oh, Chinese are like Jews. I'm like, no, they're not.
No, they're not.
Because, Chinese love money, for sure. They like money, and they'll rip you off, and they might not give you a good deal if you're not Chinese, and they'll ethnically network with other Chinese. But they're not trying to pervert our media and destroy our culture. They're here to get...
They're not trying to destroy our race, even. Yeah. In fact, they probably have more respect for it than even we do.
Yeah, on some level, ways. They probably do. But they are showing... I mean, they are apolitically coming in and just getting a huge economic benefit from what is here. And, you know, and in other countries, it's a, you know, a lot of people feel like they've like bought up half of Australia.
Yeah.
So there is a
problem. And New Zealand, by the way.
Yeah. And New Zealand.
I'm kidding.
But they,
I'm joking.
No, but they are.
I actually kind of like Asian people. Like, you know,
I don't mind them. It depends.
I don't have any. I like some Asian people. Like I don't have any personal Asian friends, but I don't mind them. Like they don't really.
Well, they don't bug you.
They don't bug.
There's nothing about, they're quiet and they stand. Look, that'll be funny in the debates. Yang will just be there in the corner. Politely standing there. They won't ask him any questions.
That's what's going to happen.
Yep.
That's what's going to happen. He's going to be polite, waiting for his turn, and his turn will just never come. He's gonna be like the guy in Office Space that's passing the cake. He's like, oh, I didn't get a piece of the cake. He's going to be that guy.
He won't even really be mad about it.
Yeah, and that's what's going to hurt him during the election. He has a chance. I mean, he's a dark horse for sure. It's like, you know, like when you watch the World Cup and you root for Croatia, and lo and behold, they got to the World Cup. You know, yeah. It's just a combination of combination of luck, hard work, things like that. You know, and
Asians love their luck.
Yeah, I was just going to say. Look.
Anyway, but yeah, anyway, it'll be interesting to see. But we're almost at we're almost at 3 hours. I didn't think we were going to go that long today.
It was a great show, though.
But we should sign up. I'm kind of tuckered out, so to speak.
Yeah.
Let me get this together, and we will see everybody next week. So yes, see ya.
Bye bye.
So.
Like dawn light and black sound, all darkness will be overthrown. All darkness will be overthrown. Instead, one is given a great gift, born in darkness and darkest days. He is given trials, mountains to lift. Aye, the very Minotaur in his maze. He is called to be strong, to be swift. A hero upon which his sons gaze. So appear you king, or appear you slave. Among the good, or a people strayed. With actions now, the future pave. For the coward is he who delayed, product of his age, cradle to grave. But an age makes not, it is man-made. It is man-made.